Chapter 5 The Overseas Chinese. The overseas Chinese are the largest of the world's middlemen minorities. At the beginning of the 20th century, there were an estimated 7 million Chinese living outside of China. By mid-century, this had doubled to 14 million, and by 1993, there were an estimated 36 million overseas Chinese. While Chinese communities arose in such far-flung locations as Britain, Peru, New Zealand, and the Caribbean, the chief concentrations of the overseas Chinese have been in the nations of Southeast Asia. The worldwide distribution of the overseas Chinese in 1993 was as follows. Africa, 108,000. Europe, 757,000. Western Hemisphere, 3,802,000. Oceania, 407,000. Asia, 31,054,000. Total, 36,128,000. The overseas Chinese have often been called the Jews of Asia, but perhaps the Jews might be called the Chinese of the West. The overseas Chinese are not only far more numerous than the Jews, but have also played a far larger economic role in the countries of Southeast Asia than even the considerable economic role of the Jews in Europe and America. The largest conglomerate in Indonesia is controlled by an overseas Chinese businessman, one of a number of ethnically Chinese billionaires in Southeast Asia. Though less than 5% of the Indonesian population, the overseas Chinese have controlled an estimated 70% of the country's private domestic capital and run 3/4 of its 200 largest businesses. In Thailand, ethnic Chinese, about 10% of the population, have controlled all 4 of the largest private banks. Altogether, ethnic Chinese living outside of China produced as much wealth as China itself in the early 1990s. Of the 5 billionaires in Indonesia and Thailand in the late 20th century, all were ethnically Chinese. Although this level of prosperity did not occur overnight, there has long been a pattern throughout Southeast Asia of most of the firms and most of the investment in whole industries being in the hands of the Chinese minority, which has been less than 10% of the population of that region. Typically, their enterprises have been family-controlled and family-run, even when they have been giant multinational corporations. The Chinese have also been a numerically small but economically significant factor in a number of Western Hemisphere nations. In the Jamaican capital of Kingston, the Chinese at one time owned most of the grocery stores. They also owned most of the grocery stores in Peru's capital city, Lima, as well as most of the shoe stores, department stores, and hotels in that city. They have had similar success in retail trade in Panama, where most of the towns have had Chinese grocery stores, restaurants, and dry goods stores. Like most middleman minorities, the overseas Chinese have been a predominantly urban people, concentrated especially in the principal metropolises of the nations in which they have settled. In various times and countries, more than half the Chinese population has been concentrated in one city: Bangkok in Thailand, Manila in the Philippines, Lima in Peru, Buenos Aires in Argentina, Saigon in South Vietnam, Vientiane in Laos, and Phnom Penh in Cambodia. Most of the Chinese in Brazil lived either in Sao Paulo or in Rio de Janeiro. Like other minorities, Chinese may all look alike to outsiders, but their internal differences are sharp and enduring, both in China and overseas. Chinese from different parts of China not only speak in ways that are mutually unintelligible, but also operate overseas in different social networks that are often mutually exclusive in both personal and business matters. But while these networks typically do not include all the Chinese in a given country, they link similar groups of Chinese internationally. Regional networks link the Hokkiens or Yunnanese of Indonesia or Singapore with people of similar ancestral origins in South China who live on the other side of the Pacific. The regional mixture of the overseas Chinese does not match the regional mixture of people in China, nor is this mixture the same in all overseas countries. The primary source of the overseas Chinese emigration were the two southern provinces of Fujian and Guangdong, which in the 19th century contained only about 10-15% of the population of China. Even within these two southern provinces, the origins of people immigrating to particular places has varied considerably. The Cantonese have historically constituted the bulk of Chinese immigrants to the United States, Canada, and Latin America. But in Southeast Asian countries, the Cantonese have been a minority within the Chinese minority. More broadly, the Chinese of Thailand, the Indochina region, and the United States originated mostly in China's Guangdong, now Guangdong province, which contains the city of Canton, now Guangzhou, while the Chinese in the Philippines, Malaysia, and Singapore originated mostly in the province of Fujian. The localization of origins and destinations has sometimes been even more specific. Of all the Chinese who immigrated to the United States before World War I, a majority came from Toshan, just one of 98 districts in Guangdong province. Moreover, the occupations of the overseas Chinese have historically been highly correlated with their respective places of origin in China, and have remained so decades or even generations later. The strong regional ties of the overseas Chinese are also reflected in more than 1,000 regional organizations to which they belong. Overseas Chinese have long been known as joiners and have more than 8,000 organizations altogether. Almost all overseas Chinese belong to some Chinese organization. Enormous diversity may be concealed in a common label. To speak of China during the Ming Dynasty is to refer to an area 10 times the size of France and an era longer than the entire history of the United States. To speak of the Chinese language and its dialects, as if we were speaking of English as spoken by the Scots and the Irish, is to ignore profound linguistic differences which made Chinese dialects mutually unintelligible as spoken words, though people educated in written, non-phonetic Chinese characters could communicate on paper in that medium, much as Spaniards and Russians can understand the same written Arabic numerals while pronouncing them in entirely different ways. Although Chinese traders, immigrants, or sojourners have been found in various parts of Southeast Asia for many centuries, large-scale emigration from China is much more recent in history. There were only an estimated 100,000 Chinese living in the region prior to the mass immigration of Chinese laborers in the 19th century. This emigration coincided with turbulent times in China, including famines and wars. The consolidation of European imperialism in Southeast Asia provided security, order, and economic opportunities sorely lacking in the declining Manchu dynasty. One measure of China's travails was an absolute decline in population from approximately 391 million in 1842 to 307 million by 1885. This was not due to emigration alone, by any means. All 7 million Chinese overseas at the turn of the century would account for only a small fraction of the population decline. What was happening in China was the disintegration of a nation that had a history and a culture that went back thousands of years, and which had once been the leading nation in the world in technology, scholarship, commerce, and organization. China was a nation centuries before Christ. Confucius was born nearly a century before Socrates. Cast iron was produced in China 1,000 years before it was produced in Europe, and the tonnage of cast iron produced in China in 1078 greatly exceeded that produced in England 7 centuries later. Printing existed in China centuries before its first appearance in Europe. Gunpowder likewise originated in China. Chinese metropolises of more than 2 million people each existed at a time when the largest city in Europe contained no more than 54,000 residents. Commerce, though officially deplored in Confucian philosophy, flourished in China. Economic development in China in the 11th century was at a level reached by no European nation until the 18th century. In the 14th century, China had the most advanced agriculture in the world, and as late as the 16th century, China had the world's highest standard of living. Yet China was not simply overtaken by the later progress of European nations. Internal decline and disintegration appeared in many forms, including technological stagnation under stifling government economic controls, neglect of military defenses, widespread corruption, and eventually a fragmenting of the country as local warlords gained control of particular regions, and foreigners, both Japanese and Europeans, began to prey on a weakened China. It was from this China that massive emigration began in the 19th century. Although the overseas Chinese have become widely known as a middleman minority, Chinese immigrants seldom began overseas as businessmen. In the era of mass Chinese immigration, most of these immigrants began overseas as coolie laborers, destitute, illiterate, unskilled workers, often in debt for their passage and indentured to whoever paid for it. Early Chinese immigrants almost always began in the lowliest unskilled tasks, often jobs considered too dirty, difficult, dangerous, or menial for the local peoples to accept. The different rates at which individual Chinese rose from such occupations contributed to the economic diversity of the overseas Chinese communities. As with the Jews, the more successful Chinese provided the stereotypes which the larger society associated with the group as a whole, even when Chinese peddlers and small shopkeepers outnumbered commercial giants and Chinese laborers outnumbered them all. Overall, however, the overseas Chinese as a group have usually averaged considerably higher incomes than the surrounding populations of the countries in which they lived. As of 1969, for example, Chinese American families earned 12% higher incomes than the average American family, and in less developed countries, the differences have usually been far greater. In Malaysia, the Chinese have usually averaged about double the income of the Malays, and in Jamaica, more than double the income of the average Jamaican. This did not mean that the overseas Chinese were rich, especially not in third world countries, where general economic levels have been low. It was once a common practice for those who succeeded overseas to return to China to spend their old age. However, post-World War II political developments, and especially the takeover of China itself by the communists, sharply reduced the repatriation of overseas Chinese to the homeland and made them more of a permanent part of the societies in which they lived. Because Chinese immigrations to many nations began as virtually all-male immigrations, many have throughout history married with local women, producing mixed offspring who have become culturally Chinese in some places and times and culturally assimilated into the larger society in other places and times. Some Chinese families have remained culturally Chinese for generations, whether or not they remained biologically pure Chinese. Sometimes the same individual would present himself as a member of the indigenous culture and society when dealing with indigenous customers, and as Chinese when dealing with other Chinese businessmen. Many Chinese never became citizens of the countries in which they lived, though their families remained there for generations. Others did become citizens, especially after World War II, and particularly after the communist victory in China made their return highly unlikely. In recent years, the very phrase overseas Chinese has been challenged as obsolete, insofar as it connotes people temporarily absent from China. Such wide diversities in social reality have been reflected in huge disparities in statistics on the number of Chinese in various countries. A 1936 census in Indochina, for example, listed 326,000 Chinese, but an independent scholar put the figure at more than 1 million. Much depends on whether one counts as Chinese only Chinese nationals or includes people of Chinese ancestry who hold citizenship in the local country or whose citizenship is in doubt, or whether one counts as Chinese only those who consider themselves Chinese, omitting others of the same racial mixture who consider themselves Thais, Burmese, or Filipino, for example. Australian census statistics on the Chinese, for example, refer to persons born in China, even though these are, 1, a minority of the ethnically Chinese in Australia, and 2, include many white Russians who were born in China. Our definition of the overseas Chinese will be based on those who are ethnically Chinese, regardless of citizenship or nativity. Racial mixtures also complicate the count of Chinese. In some cases, the part Chinese may be not only estranged from the Chinese community, but even hostile to it. In some countries of Southeast Asia, part Chinese politicians have spearheaded anti-Chinese movements. This parallels the situation among Spanish Jews, whose 15th century expulsion from Spain was partly the work of Jewish converts to Christianity. Although it may seem paradoxical that the Chinese generally prosper in other countries, where they have historically been subjected to both sweeping discrimination and sporadic mob violence, but remain very poor in China, That is nevertheless the case. Per capita income in China in the late 20th century was less than half that of Taiwan and less than one-seventh that of Singapore, to compare it only with other Chinese states in the area. On the world scene, China remained one of the poorest nations, after having once been the richest. Southeast Asia. China, its people, and its culture have spread into Southeast Asia for many centuries. However, most Chinese in Southeast Asia in the 20th century are not descendants of those Chinese who moved into this region in the early centuries of the Christian era or during the Sung, Yuan, or early Ming dynasties. Large-scale emigration from China into Southeast Asia began only after European colonial powers, Portuguese, Spanish, Dutch, and British, consolidated their control in the region in the 16th and early 17th centuries and created stable conditions in which Chinese immigrants could feel secure. Before then, the Chinese were neither a large nor a predominant element among the foreigners in the region, who included Arabs, Persians, and people from India. The high tide of Chinese immigration into Southeast Asia, the late 19th and early 20th centuries, coincided with the high tide of European imperialism in the region. The initial wave of Chinese immigrants to Southeast Asia usually brought with them no special skills other than a capacity for long and hard work and a tenacity in seeking to advance themselves through painful thrift and the risks of setting up their own tiny businesses with their savings. In the process, the overseas Chinese have brought retail stores and eventually other elements of a modern commercial and industrial world into traditional rural peasant societies in Southeast Asia. With the passing generations and increasing prosperity, the overseas Chinese have branched out into a variety of economic ventures and have established their own schools in which their children could be educated. Among the factors in their entrepreneurial success has been their ability to conduct business among themselves and with others on the strength of verbal agreements. This gave them an advantage over local businessmen who lacked the same credibility, even with local clienteles and creditors. The ties of the overseas Chinese to their homeland have historically been reflected in their remittances to families in China, as well as in repatriation in old age or after achieving prosperity. These remittances to China, and returns to China with the savings of many years, have been a source of bitter political accusations that the overseas Chinese were draining away the wealth of the countries in which they lived and worked. These political charges proceeded on the implicit assumption that there is either a fixed or a preordained level of wealth in the host country, from which the Chinese subtract the sums that they send or take back to China. From an economic standpoint, such charges collapse when the sums sent or taken by the overseas Chinese are seen as, one, a fraction of the wealth they have created and added to the host country's economy, and, two, representing what the Chinese would have spent on themselves and their families wherever they were located, leaving the rest of the population no better or worse off because of the remittances or residual choices of the Chinese. But, however economically questionable, these charges have been politically effective. The rise of the communist government on the mainland of China has led to a sharp decline in both repatriation and remittances from overseas, the latter due to confiscatory practices of the communists. Taiwan, however, continued to receive large sums from the overseas Chinese, who invested more than $147 million there in 1979. Moreover, hostility and discrimination toward the Chinese by no means declined with the decline in remittances and repatriation to China. On the contrary, escalating discrimination in Indonesia and Malaysia, for example, led to outflows of Chinese capital to Singapore, Hong Kong, and elsewhere. Thailand. For several centuries, the Chinese have been part of the history of Thailand, or Siam, as it was known for a large part of its history. During much of that time, the Chinese were well received by the Thais, and there was considerable intermarriage, extending all the way to the royal family. There was a Chinese high official in the Thai government as early as the 15th century, the first of many Chinese to hold high office and receive official honors. Moreover, the prestige of Chinese civilization was high in Thailand. But, despite this historical background, severe inter-ethnic tensions and discrimination developed in 20th century Thailand, in the wake of major social and especially political changes. While Chinese immigration to Thailand goes back for centuries, neither data nor reliable estimates were available until the late 19th century, when from 13,000 to 34,000 Chinese per year were entering the country. Altogether, nearly 1.5 million Chinese immigrants entered Thailand from 1882 to 1917, a huge number for a small country to absorb, but about 2/3 of these immigrants returned to China, a pattern common among the overseas Chinese of that era. Nevertheless, those who remained and propagated created a growing Chinese population estimated at 100,000 in 1825, increasing to 349,000 by 1917, rising from about 5% of the total population of Thailand in 1825 to about 10% in 1917. The Chinese were concentrated disproportionately in and around Bangkok, where they constituted about half of the local population by the mid-19th century. But even in areas where the Chinese were more thinly spread, their economic impact was out of all proportion to their numbers. Most of the Chinese who immigrated to Thailand were themselves poor and came from poor southern coastal provinces of China, areas subject to flood and drought, with attendant widespread hunger. Thailand, by contrast, has historically been a country of abundant, fertile land. Against this background, it is not surprising that contrasting attitudes and behavior patterns have long been observed between the Chinese and the Thais. Extreme thrift has been one of the striking characteristics of the Chinese, in Thailand as elsewhere. Even the Chinese common laborer in 19th century Bangkok could save more than half his earnings. No such frugality was necessary for the Thais, whose adage, "rice on the lands, fish in the waters," expressed the ready availability of subsistence. Thais who worked on construction of the first railroad in Thailand in the late 19th century were noted for leaving after a few days to go spend their earnings in the nearest town. Most of the work had to be done by Chinese immigrants. Thais tended to remain peasants in traditional agriculture, while the Chinese predominated in occupations requiring arduous labor, skills, or entrepreneurship. Chinese workers were noted as the first people to get up in the morning in Bangkok, where large numbers of Chinese blacksmiths were found forging iron before daybreak by a British visitor in 1833. Canals and railroads were built with Chinese labor. The Chinese also pulled rickshaws, a job spurned by the Thais. An ethnic division of labor emerged, in which the growing Thai population was absorbed producing rice, while the Chinese dominated virtually all other labor, business, and industrial activity, except for fields where other foreigners made major contributions. Even in agriculture, it was the Chinese who introduced new crops and new methods, supplied most of the labor on rubber plantations, as well as financing the Thai peasant, purchasing his rice production, owning the rice mills, and managing the distribution of rice, both domestically and internationally. The Chinese immigrants of the pre-World War I era were at least 90% male, and among the few females, a significant proportion went into brothels. About half the Chinese males who remained in Thailand for 5 years or more married Thai women. Their offspring could choose whether to be regarded as Thai or Chinese, for both social and legal purposes, but a choice was necessary. The Chinese were by no means a homogeneous group within themselves. The various dialect groups were not only socially separate, each had its own separate cemetery in Bangkok, but in some cases had a history of mutual hostility in China. During the 1860s, fights between the Hakkas and the Cantonese in China's Guangdong province cost an estimated 100,000 lives. In Thailand as well, their feuds sometimes led to armed battles between the Tongs, or secret societies, that flourished among the Chinese in countries around the world. For all the wide range of occupations engaged in, and even dominated by the Chinese, they seldom pursued political careers or engaged in organized and sustained political activity for ethnic interests in Thailand. Even those Chinese who achieved important government positions typically did so as individuals rather than as spokesmen for an organized Chinese political constituency, and their elevation to office often removed them further from the Chinese community and its special interests. The politics that mattered to the Chinese in Thailand were the politics of China. Within Thailand, they were submissive to the Thai royalty and aristocracy, and on the few occasions when they were not, their uprisings were quickly and bloodily crushed. Those Chinese who elected to become naturalized Thais were subject to all the duties that fell to the Thai masses under an autocratic government. Those who chose to remain Chinese citizens had to pay a special tax. A 19th century observer noted that there is nothing that the Siamese policeman so much enjoys as leading some unfortunate Chinaman to pay the tax. The whole set of procedures surrounding this tax demeaned the Chinese. This and a variety of other taxes on things largely confined to the Chinese, such as opium and gambling, led to the Thai government's receiving nearly half its total revenue from the Chinese minority. By and large, the Chinese and the Thais coexisted with relatively little friction on into the early 20th century. Events in China, however, promoted a growing sense of nationalism among the overseas Chinese, including those in Thailand. Japan's successful war against China in 1895 was the first of a series of events promoting a sense of national consciousness among Chinese, notorious for their regional or local perspectives. The Chinese Revolution of 1911 and the long struggle of Sun Yat-sen to unify the country all captured the imagination of the overseas Chinese, who contributed financially to his efforts. A second round of Japanese aggression against China, beginning in the 1930s, aroused still more Chinese nationalism overseas. Coinciding with these political trends was a social trend that reinforced separation of the Chinese from the Thais, an increase in the number of Chinese women immigrating into the country. As of 1910, a Chinese woman was a rare sight in Bangkok, but by 1930, they were a substantial social phenomenon and growing. From about 15% of all Chinese immigrants in the early 1920s, women became 27% from the decade beginning in 1932, and 32% of the immigrants settling permanently. One consequence of this was a sharp decline in the rate of intermarriage between Chinese men and Thai women. The preference of Chinese men for Chinese women was shown in the higher bride prices these women commanded, as compared to the bride price for Thai or mixed Thai-Chinese women. Along with a drop in biological assimilation went a decline in cultural assimilation, as Chinese immigration hit record levels between the end of World War I and the beginning of the Great Depression of the 1930s. An annual immigration of 68,000 rose to a peak of 155,000 in the 1927-28 official year. For the entire period 1918 to 1931, more than 1.3 million Chinese immigrants entered Thailand, and, while most continued to depart as well, there was a net addition of about 500,000 to the Chinese population of the country. Along with the more or less automatic reinforcement of the Chinese culture implied by growing immigration and declining intermarriage, there were conscious efforts to perpetuate a separate ethnic identity among the Chinese in Thailand through the creation, beginning around 1911, of Chinese schools, emphasizing the Chinese language and culture, and Chinese politics. The first decade of the 20th century also saw the first community-wide Chinese organizations in Thailand, cutting across dialect lines, yet another sign of growing Chinese nationalism. At about the same time, a new European-educated Thai elite was developing Thai nationalism, and with it, a growing suspicion, resentment, and hostility toward the Chinese. A Chinese protest boycott against tax law changes in 1910 shut down the city of Bangkok, engendering enormous and lasting resentment among the Thais, without having any effect on the tax laws. Chinese separatism, Chinese domination of the economy in general, and their role as moneylenders to Thai peasants in particular, all came in for critical re-examination. An era of Thai-Chinese antagonism was beginning, with political power firmly in the hands of the Thais. In the economy, the Chinese were as dominant as ever in the years between the two world wars. The four major exports of Thailand, rice, timber, tin, and rubber, were all largely in Chinese hands, with competition coming primarily from foreigners, Europeans, Australians, and Americans, and with the Thais virtually spectators at the economic development of their country. Westerners tended to compete best with the Chinese in industries requiring very large capital investments, such as dredge mining, forestry, and steam-powered rice mills. Europeans remained dominant in forestry, though the Chinese owned 3 of the 9 modern sawmills in Bangkok in 1924, and the labor in all 9 sawmills was predominantly Chinese. In mining, the Chinese lacked the capital for dredging equipment, but most of the miners were Chinese. In rubber, the Chinese dominated at every level, from the plantation workers to the owners and rubber merchants. Market gardening, sugar production, and fish exporting were among the other industries where the Chinese remained supreme. While Westerners could command more vast capital resources than the Chinese, the advantage of the Chinese was in a far more intimate knowledge of the country, its people, and customs. In credit operations, such as those involving the Thai peasant, this meant knowing each farmer so well as to be able to gauge repayment prospects that varied greatly from individual to individual, according to a host of attitudinal as well as objective conditions. The boundary between Chinese and Western predominance in sectors of the Thai economy tended to run along lines reflecting the relative importance of huge capital investments versus knowledge of the local scene. Industries which simply extracted raw material for shipment overseas required less local knowledge and more vast capital, so it is hardly surprising to find Western firms predominating in tin mining or forestry. But local retailing was overwhelmingly Chinese in Thailand, as throughout Southeast Asia. Large Western-owned commercial establishments usually lacked the knowledge of the local languages, customs, or conditions necessary to deal directly with Thai customers or with Chinese retailers, and so employed Chinese agents to act as intermediaries. Theoretically, they could have hired Thai intermediaries, but they found the Chinese more industrious and knowledgeable, and the Thais too easygoing for their business purposes. The evolution of the rice milling industry in Thailand illustrates the changing relations of Western and Chinese advantages. Initially, when rice was milled by hand, the rice exported from Thailand came almost entirely from Chinese mills. But Western mechanized and steam-powered rice mills, built in the 1850s and 1860s, began to make inroads, until the Chinese ordered similar equipment from England in the 1870s. By 1879, the Chinese owned as many steam-powered rice mills as the Westerners, and by 1919, all Western-owned rice mills had either closed down or had been sold to the Chinese. Conversely, where very large capital investments held decisive advantages, Westerners tended to prevail. In the import-export trade, for example, the Chinese in Thailand were dominant for centuries, but huge Western square-rigged sailing ships began displacing the smaller, more shallow-draft Chinese junks in the 19th century, and the appearance of steam-powered ships added to the Western advantage. By 1890, the British alone carried 2/3 of the foreign trade, with other Western ships carrying more than 1/3, and only 2% of the tonnage being carried in junks. Nevertheless, this drastic reduction in Chinese shipping, where capital was decisive, did not similarly reduce the Chinese role in the trading end of the import-export business, where knowledge was decisive. In 1890, despite British dominance in shipping to Bangkok, the Chinese still conducted 62% of the import-export business, operating as agents for Western shippers as well as on their own. Although many leading businessmen in Thailand were Chinese, this did not mean that most Chinese in Thailand were prosperous. Numerous Chinese lived in huts with the earth for a floor in the countryside, or lived in the back of the shops in town, often without electricity or toilet facilities. Nor were all Chinese businessmen. In the non-agricultural sector of the Thai economy, approximately 70% of the workers were Chinese. A 19th century observer described Chinese vegetable gardeners in Bangkok as living in small dirty huts within their premises, guarded by a multitude of dogs and a horrible stench of pigsties. Still, what struck many Thais was the prominence of the Chinese among the affluent members of the society. The historic role of the Chinese in the economic development of Thailand was often forgotten, and their prosperity was attributed to some undefined exploitation. Chinese moneylenders were often blamed for the poverty of the Thai peasant. In reality, money lending was a highly competitive business, and Thai lenders offered no better terms than the Chinese. Sometimes resentments have been based on charges of sharp business practices by the Chinese. Such charges are difficult to assess in a country where buyer and seller alike engaged in widespread petty cheating that was mutually expected and, within limits, accepted. Were the Chinese to engage in more cheating than local businessmen, or otherwise charge higher prices, or offer inferior merchandise, local competition could undercut them and replace them. Yet, throughout Southeast Asia, Chinese businessmen were seldom matched by locals for price, credit terms, or conditions of sale. It was the Chinese who undercut, a fact lamented by those who also complained, inconsistently, of Chinese exploitation of the consumer. Their low profit margins have made them formidable competitors for Europeans and Southeast Asians alike. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, the Thai government began a nationalistic policy designed to secure employment to Thai nationals. Since the overwhelming majority of foreigners in Thailand were Chinese, this was in effect a blow to them, though many Chinese were also Thai citizens. Taxi driving was restricted to Thai nationals. Remittances to China were restricted. Chinese schools were restricted in their curriculum. Chinese nationalistic propaganda banned, and some schools were closed for violations or evasions. More anti-Chinese laws and edicts followed during World War II, especially after the Japanese took control of Thailand. Despite decades of laws and policies designed to move Thais out of traditional agriculture and into the modern economy, and especially into commerce and industry, the Thais took relatively little advantage of the opportunities. A law in the mid-1930s required rice mills to employ at least 50% Thai workers, but proved impossible to carry out due to a lack of such labor. In 1939, a new law authorized the government to require up to 75% Thai employees in both public and private enterprises, but a lack of qualified Thais prevented the government from implementing it for fear of damage to the economy. During World War II, a forced evacuation of Chinese from various parts of Thailand caused many Chinese businessmen to sell their businesses to Thais at a fraction of their value, but this did not lead to a large Thai business class. Most of the better economic opportunities created by wartime restrictions on the Chinese were seized by Japanese businessmen, not Thais. Even in post-war Thailand, Thai neighborhoods still had Chinese shops. The very attempts at preventing the development of Chinese separatism had the effect of fostering a heightened sense of ethnic identity in the beleaguered group, and the economic advantages of the Chinese persisted as well. They continued to own from 80 to 90% of the rice mills, the largest enterprises in the country. Moreover, the Chinese dominated every phase of rice production except the actual farming. Chinese bought the rice, transported it, milled it, and did three-quarters of the exporting of rice from Thailand. Even some of the government-owned enterprises, set up to reduce the role of the Chinese in the economy, ended up hiring Chinese managers. What the growing restrictions on the Chinese and the growing preferences for Thais accomplished was to make it necessary for the Chinese to bribe Thai officials, both directly and indirectly, to allow them to perform economic functions that only they could perform. High officials of the Thai government became directors and partners of Chinese businesses, lending their political influence to get the Chinese businesses through the growing maze of government regulations and preferential policies, ostensibly for the benefit of the Thai masses. One of the ironies of the overseas Chinese is that this historically accomplished capitalist group has also become prominent on the political left, including the communist movement. The Chinese greatly outnumbered the Thais in the communist movement in Thailand. The overseas Chinese also constituted a majority of the communist movements in Malaysia. A similar pattern of overrepresentation on the political left has also been observed among another historically capitalistic middleman minority, the Jews. This does not mean that most overseas Chinese or Jews have been communist or even part of the political left. It does mean that, among those on the political left in those countries, this consummately capitalist group has supplied more than its share. Malaysia. While Thailand has the largest number of overseas Chinese of any nation in Southeast Asia, an estimated 6 million people, Malaysia has the highest proportion of overseas Chinese in its population, 29%. Socially, the Chinese have been more clearly separated from the majority population in Malaysia than in Thailand, for the great majority of Malays are Muslims, for whom intermarriage with non-Muslims is out of the question, and such features of the Chinese culture as fondness for pork and gambling tend to limit social interactions in general. There have been few interracial neighborhoods in Malaysia, as well as little intermarriage, even when there was a substantial surplus of males in both the Chinese and Indian minorities. The British colony of Malaya received its independence in 1957 as the Federation of Malaya. With the addition of Singapore and parts of the island of Borneo in 1963, it became Malaysia. 2 years later, Singapore became a separate and independent city-state. Like the Thais, the Malays were not a people ground into poverty by lack of land or resources. On the contrary, abundant land and ample rainfall made it possible for the Malay peasant to live all year on one crop, produced in a few months, even though the land was quite capable of producing two crops a year if necessary. This left leisure for the development of a relaxed lifestyle, as seen by some, or laziness, as seen by others. Malaya was also richly endowed with some of the most extensive deposits of tin ore in the world, as well as rich petroleum deposits and other minerals. The climate and soil were also suitable for growing rubber trees, eventually making Malaya the world's leading producer of rubber. But the development of all these resources was largely the work of foreigners, not Malays. Those Malays with wealth usually did not choose to invest it in such enterprises, and among less affluent Malays, relatively few were willing to work on rubber plantations or in tin mines when they had the option of a less arduous life on their own land. Capital for the development of Malaya's resources was largely supplied by Western nations, while the labor needed came largely from China, India, and Ceylon. These workers were typically illiterate and very poor people from nations where making a living was much harder than for the Malays, and where the dangers of hunger and starvation had created habits of thrift as well as hard work. Where some Malays did work alongside the Chinese on rubber plantations, both performing identical unskilled labor, the output per worker was more than twice as high among the Chinese as among the Malays. Unlike the Chinese and the Indians, Malays were also notorious for free spending and for going into debt for the sake of social celebrations. The numbers of Chinese in the region that was eventually consolidated into Malaysia were quite small before the era of European colonialism. However, as early as 1794, a British report on the Penang settlement described the Chinese as the most valuable part of our inhabitants, possessing a variety of artisan skills, as well as being shopkeepers, planters, and boatmen. The Chinese were also described as indefatigable in the pursuit of money. Under British rule, there was substantial Chinese immigration into the whole region, many fleeing a breakdown of law and order in China during and after the Taiping Rebellion in the middle of the 19th century. In the Malay states, not counting Singapore, Penang, or Malacca, the Chinese population rose from an estimated 100,000 in 1881 to more than 1 million just 50 years later. By 1941, the Chinese actually outnumbered the Malays in British Malaya. These Chinese played a major role in the economic development of the country. At the turn of the century, Malaya produced one half the tin in the world, and Chinese miners helped develop this industry. By 1931, there were nearly 79,000 Chinese miners and more than 160,000 Chinese growing rubber. Over the years, they spread out into other occupations, beginning at the very bottom in occupations rejected by most Malays. The Chinese rose economically, many using their savings to open tiny businesses, some of which grew into more substantial enterprises. Whereas more than half of all Chinese in Malaya in 1911 were either agricultural laborers or mining laborers, just 20 years later, only 11% of the Chinese were in these two occupations. The Chinese came ultimately to own 85% of all retail outlets in the country. Although a vital part of the economy and a substantial portion of the population, about one-third by 1931, the Chinese remained in separate enclaves, speaking their own languages, establishing their own community institutions, and having little interest in Malay culture or social life, which they looked down upon. Their social, cultural, and political orientations were all toward China. But along with these sojourning Chinese, looking to return to China after achieving some financial success in Malaya, there also developed a native-born community of Chinese with local roots, the so-called Straits Chinese. As in Thailand, much of the commercial and industrial competition faced by the Chinese in Malaya came from foreigners rather than from the indigenous population. Indian laborers came to predominate on the rubber plantations, and Indian businessmen were significant in the Malay economy. European capital and technology competed with the Chinese in tin mining and eventually became predominant. As of 1920, the Chinese-owned mines produced nearly two-thirds of the tin in Malaya, but by 1938, the European mines produced two-thirds. The Malays themselves played a negligible role as investors, owners, or managers. As of 1931, non-Malays owned 99% of the rubber holdings in Malaya, the Europeans and Americans owning 84%, the Chinese 13%, and the Indians 2%. Even as workers, the Malays were seldom involved in this major industry of the Malayan economy. The British colonial government gave various legal preferences to the Malays, such as providing free schooling to Malay children, but not Chinese children, and preferentially hiring Malays for the civil service. But the initially illiterate Chinese began to establish private schools for their children to be educated. Moreover, the Malays, even at the university level, tended to be educated in subjects that prepared them only to be clerks, while the Chinese university students specialized in medicine, science, and technical fields. Nevertheless, in education as in the economy, the relative success of the Chinese should not obscure the reality that many Chinese were far less fortunate than those whose striking success generated envy and resentment among the Malays. As late as 1950, less than half the Chinese children of school age received even primary schooling, and less than one-third the total Chinese population of the country was literate. World War II and its aftermath tended to alienate Malays and Chinese from one another. 10 days after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, crippling the American Pacific Fleet and gaining naval superiority throughout the Far East, Japanese troops invaded Penang. 2 months later, Singapore surrendered, and the long nightmare of Japanese occupation began for the Chinese in Malaya. Chinese who had contributed money or other support to China in its resistance to the Japanese invaders or to the defense of Malaya were cited by informers and executed by the Japanese. So were many other categories of Chinese considered potentially bothersome by the occupation authorities. The massacres lasted for days. Altogether, about 5,000 Chinese were killed. Meanwhile, many Malays collaborated with the Japanese during the war, creating a bitterness between Chinese and Malays that lasted into the post-war era. Although the British had long before established political machinery for moving Malaya toward independence, the divisiveness in post-war Malaya made this more difficult. Economic differences compounded political differences, and the demographic makeup of the population further complicated matters. The average Chinese male earned more than double the income of the average Malay male. In Malaya, as it was constituted in 1948, the population was divided, truly divided, into 45% Chinese, 43% Malay, and 10% Indian. Moreover, the anti-Japanese guerrilla movement from World War II, virtually all Chinese, turned into a communist-led guerrilla movement, trying to take over the country. In hopes of reconciling the three major ethnic groups enough to permit a viable nation after independence, the principal political parties representing each group formed a coalition called the Alliance Party. In this alliance, the Malayan Chinese Association and the Malayan Indian Congress were subordinated to the Malays' political representative, the United Malays National Organization. The compromise by which they hoped to avert intergroup strife and carnage after independence involved political priority for the Malays as an offset to the economic predominance of the Chinese. Rural and urban votes were weighted in such a way as to guarantee Malay predominance, since the Chinese were largely urban and the Malays largely rural. Moreover, the constitution provided that the head of state had to be a Malay, that the state religion was Islam, and that Malay was the national language. In the social and economic sphere, the constitution established preferential treatment of the Malays in government employment, university scholarships, and in the issuance of business permits and licenses. In exchange, non-Malays received somewhat more liberalized citizenship qualifications and, crucial to the Chinese and the Indians, freedom to continue engaging in business with relatively little government interference. This compromise was by no means universally accepted. It was in fact attacked politically by both Chinese and Malay parties outside the alliance. Some dissident Chinese criticized the plan for giving too much to the Malays, while dissident Malays demanded still more. Singapore's People's Action Party demanded a Malaysia without any ethnic privileges or restrictions, where all Malaysians would be equal under the law. This principle was seen by the ruling Alliance Party as a threat to the basic compromise on which hopes of a peaceful transition to independence were based. Moreover, the People's Action Party's wily leader, Lee Kuan Yew, was seen as a potential mobilizer of the Chinese throughout the country, who outnumbered the Malays with Singapore, his political base, included in Malaysia. In 1965, Singapore was separated from Malaysia to forestall this. It was one of the rare, if not unique, examples of a nation voluntarily divesting itself of territory and people, in this case, the largest fort in Asia. The removal of predominantly Chinese Singapore now made the Malays a numerical as well as political majority in Malaysia. Economically, however, the Chinese remained dominant, but against a background of growing demands that more be done for the Malays. The Chinese were often seen as not merely more fortunate, but as exploiting the Malay peasantry. Despite attempts to depict the Malay peasant as virtually in bondage to the Chinese middleman or moneylender, only about half the farmers in Malaysia in the 1950s and 1960s were in debt, and most debts were repaid within the year. A similar pattern has been found in Thailand and Laos, but political rhetoric overwhelmed facts. Although the Alliance Party was re-elected in 1969, it lost both Malay and Chinese voters to more militant parties from each community. More important, massive race riots broke out in the capital city, Kuala Lumpur. Hundreds of Chinese were killed amid widespread burning and looting of Chinese businesses. These riots marked a watershed in Malaysia's political history. The original political compromise was readjusted to give wider and more sweeping preferences to Malays, now extending into the private sector and including new government credit sources designed to end the presumed dependence of the Malay peasant on the Chinese middleman. More fundamentally, the government committed itself to a long-range effort to eliminate the identification of race with economic function, that is, to produce statistical parity of representation of Malays throughout the economy. The Malay Bumiputras, or Sons of the Soil, were to have an institutionalized special position in the Malaysian economy and society. The actual consequences of these policies have been considerably less dramatic than the political rhetoric. Overall, Chinese income remained approximately double that of the Malays, with minor variations from survey to survey, as in the past. However, for particular sectors and classes, there were striking changes, though not usually to the benefit of the Malay masses, in whose names the preferential policies existed. The proportion of all the poor households in Peninsula Malaysia that were Malay households actually increased slightly. At the other end of the economic scale, however, the more fortunate Malays advanced still further. Government-run enterprises provided managerial positions for members of the Malay elite, including royalty. Malays with political connections served on boards of directors of large corporations, though still outnumbered by Chinese directors, who usually came from a business background. Both were still outnumbered by foreign directors. There has been a growing Malay share in the stock of businesses in Malaysia, but these shares have usually been held by the government in the name of the Malay people, rather than by individual Malay stockholders. These industries have usually been unprofitable in direct proportion to the percentage of government ownership. Malay private businesses likewise made little headway in competition with the Chinese, for even Malay customers often preferred doing business with non-Malay firms. Chinese businesses seeking to circumvent government restrictions have operated behind Malay frontmen so widely as to give rise to the popular expression Alibaba Enterprises, where Ali is a Malay and Baba is Chinese. In one study of a local Malaysian trucking industry, 102 out of the 105 people owning and managing trucking firms were Chinese, and so were most of their employees, even though trucking was one of the licensed businesses in which Malays received preferential privileges. The most successful displacement of the Chinese was in areas totally controlled by government, notably government employment and university admissions. More than 90% of all new government jobs created in 1979-80 went to Malays. Whereas Malays were only 40% of the university students in the country in 1970, after a decade of stronger preferences, they were 67%. The number of Chinese students in the country's universities declined absolutely during the decade of the 1970s, even though total university enrollment more than doubled. One consequence was that nearly 30,000 Malaysian students went abroad to study, three-quarters of them non-Malays. Chinese capital also began to flow out of Malaysia, along with Chinese professionals. Even in the late 20th century, there were many Chinese families among the urban poor of Malaysia, including many squatters in the capital city of Kuala Lumpur. There was also a rising rate of unemployment among young urban Chinese who entered a job market that legally discriminated against them in the land of their birth. But what was politically salient was that the Chinese remained disproportionately represented among the economic leaders of the country, and that the Malays saw this as a problem to be solved. Singapore. In less than two centuries, Singapore has gone from an almost uninhabited tropical island on the tip of the Malay Peninsula to the fourth largest port in the world. It is also the anomaly of a city-state created in the 20th century, a status it has maintained since its separation from Malaysia in 1965. Aside from its harbor, Singapore has virtually no natural resources and has even had to import water piped in from Malaysia. Yet it achieved an average income approximately double that of Malaysia and one of the highest standards of living in Asia. Sir Thomas Stamford Raffles founded the British colony of Singapore in 1819. At that time, the only inhabitants were 120 Malays and 30 Chinese. Under British rule, the population grew rapidly, approaching 5,000 by 1821 and surpassing 10,000 just 2 years later. As elsewhere, the colonial authorities considered the Chinese as the most valuable part of the local population, beyond doubt, even though people from different provinces of China had to be kept separated from one another in the interest of tranquility. Over the years, the Chinese population of Singapore rose both absolutely and relative to the total population. From a minority in the 1820s, the Chinese rose to become about half of the population of Singapore by 1840, three-fifths by 1881, and three-quarters by 1931. The Chinese immigration to Singapore showed the familiar pattern of young men from southern China coming as sojourners in hopes of returning home with money for a better life. Between the sex imbalance and tropical diseases, there was no natural increase of the resident Chinese population until the 1920s. By then, there were enough women and permanently settled men to create a Singapore-born population of Chinese, in addition to the immigrant population. By 1931, there were half as many Chinese women as men in Singapore, and by 1947, just over half the population was native-born. Located centrally with respect to the other great ports of Asia, Singapore became a leading entrepôt port and a strategic link in British military power during the heyday of the empire. The fall of Singapore to the Japanese during World War II was a blow to British power throughout the region and ultimately to European colonialism in general. The Japanese occupation was also a bitter experience for the people of Singapore. Thousands were rounded up as suspected supporters of China in its war with Japan, and some were shot. In the post-war world, as independence approached for Singapore and Malaya, Western-educated Lee Kuan Yew and his People's Action Party attempted to promote the idea of equal citizenship rights for peoples of all races in newly formed Malaysia. Although this idea was rejected in Malaysia, Singapore's separation presented an opportunity for this approach to be tried in that independent and multiracial city-state. The population of Singapore, when it began as an independent state in 1963, was 1.8 million people, including a Chinese majority, 1.4 million, and sizable minorities of Malays, 257,000, Indians, 132,000, and others, 36,500. Intergroup frictions and animosities existed in Singapore as in Malaysia, and violence was by no means absent from Singapore's history. The various Chinese groups in the city had many bloody battles among themselves in the 19th century, with hundreds left dead, and Muslim riots against Europeans erupted as recently as 1950. Politically inspired riots also rocked Singapore in 1955, requiring more than 10,000 soldiers and policemen to restore order. Against this background, the challenge was to create a viable society out of these disparate and volatile elements, living in the shadow of a much larger Malaysia, equally volatile and with conflicting racial policies, a Malaysia whose ability to cut off the water supply alone meant that policies and events in Singapore could not be allowed to provoke the Malay government. De-emphasis of race and ethnicity, promotion of Singaporean patriotism, equality before the law, and acceptance of cultural differences became the cornerstones of Singapore's efforts at nation-building. Four different languages were officially recognized to accommodate the disparate groups. Among the Chinese, public policy promoted the speaking of Mandarin, a foreign language to the various southern Chinese groups, but a way of eroding the dialect group separatism which has historically plagued the Chinese in countries around the world. Urban redevelopment and public housing policies tended to break up some ethnic enclaves and, together with racially integrated military and police forces, eroded some of the group insularity that existed. While the government did not impose a single language in the school system, and in fact required bilingualism, over the years, an increasing proportion of students chose English as their second language. By 1975, nearly 70% of Singapore students were studying English, providing a lingua franca across ethnic lines, though each group spoke its own language at home. At the same time, among the adults, 1/4 of the population had no schooling at all, 43% had completed only 6 grades, and only 1% had college degrees. These data were a reminder of the grim past from which the prosperous and educated Singapore of recent years has arisen. By 1983, English was overwhelmingly the language of instruction in the public schools, from primary grades through junior college. More than 400,000 students were being taught in English, compared to fewer than 40,000 in Chinese, fewer than 500 in Malay, and fewer than 50 in Tamil. In short, most members of all three major ethnic groups were being educated in English. Despite legal equality and official de-emphasis of racial and ethnic differences, the various groups in Singapore remained largely separate socially and different economically. Less than 5% of the non-Muslim marriages in Singapore were intermarriages. Among these rare intermarriages, the most common was between Chinese and Europeans, with the wife being Chinese in nearly 9/10 of these marriages. Muslim marriages were fewer but more diverse. Almost 4/5 of all Muslim marriages in Singapore were between the Malays, another 5% between the Indians, and 16% were intermarriages, usually between Malays and Indians. Less than 3% of all Muslim marriages were between Chinese and Malays, and less than 1% of all non-Muslim marriages were between Chinese and Malays. Thus, members of the two largest groups in Singapore were the least likely to marry each other. Economic differences among the three ethnic groups also remain substantial. As of 1980, the Chinese earned 43% higher incomes than Malays. However, this was less of a differential than in Malaysia. Indians in Singapore earned incomes substantially the same as the Chinese, whereas they earned much less in Malaysia. However, Singapore Indians have historically been educated professional people to a much greater extent than the Indians in Malaysia, where about half still worked as plantation laborers. That the Malays should be doing better relative to the Chinese in Singapore than in their own country is especially striking in view of the sweeping preferential treatment of Bumiputras in Malaysia. Indonesia. The mass immigration of Chinese to what is now Indonesia began when it was a string of islands called the Dutch East Indies. These islands, including Java and Sumatra, separate the Pacific Ocean from the Indian Ocean at the equator. Chinese traders visited Java at least as far back as the 9th century, but large-scale immigration began only after the Dutch took over in the 17th century. Although there were fewer than 500 Chinese in the city of Batavia in 1619, while the Dutch were consolidating their rule, by 1733 there were 80,000 Chinese in the same city. As early as the mid-17th century, the Chinese predominated among the artisans there. They also established the first sugarcane industry in Java, where the natives had used more primitive means of producing sugar. Under the Chinese, sugar production rose to many times its previous level, and prices fell. As moneylenders, the Chinese undercut their Japanese competitors by charging lower interest with less security. All in all, the Chinese were businessmen in both petty and large-scale enterprises, and many prospered visibly, to the visible resentment of both the Dutch and the indigenous people of the islands. The Dutch authorities' attempts to control the movements and activities of the Chinese population, which included an important criminal element, led to many arbitrary edicts, harassment, and extortion. This led, in 1740, to a revolt among the Chinese, and to their slaughter by the thousands. Nevertheless, despite many vicissitudes, the Chinese gained control of most domestic and foreign commerce in Java by the beginning of the 19th century. However, this total dominance of the private economy was not destined to last. After about 1870, an inflow of European capital established large agricultural and industrial enterprises that eclipsed the smaller, family-run businesses of the Chinese. These large-scale undertakings, whether plantation agriculture, wholesaling, banking, or industrial enterprises, tended to be in the hands of the Europeans or of a new group, the Japanese. By 1921, the Dutch held 73% of all investments in plantations, wholesale trade, transport, and banking, while the Chinese held only 11%. The Chinese continued prominent in small business, where most continued to work, and they continued to be more prosperous than the Indonesians, though not nearly as prosperous as the Europeans. By 1930, there were more than 1 million Chinese in the Dutch East Indies, more than two-thirds of whom had been born there. 500,000 Chinese had fathers who were also native-born, so the Chinese population had local roots, even though it was socially distinct. The Chinese were also internally differentiated, with groups whose origins were in different parts of China being concentrated in different parts of the Dutch East Indies, working in different occupations, and varying in their respective proportions of native-born and foreign-born, as well as in male-female ratios. Earlier immigrants, predominantly male, married local women and tended to assimilate culturally, speaking the local vernacular rather than Chinese, eating local foods, wearing local clothing, and observing local customs. These immigrants and their descendants became known as Peranakans, mixed bloods, but the connotations extended beyond the biological to a whole way of life and set of values. When substantial numbers of Chinese women began arriving in the islands in the 1920s, a new kind of Chinese community came into being, the Totoks, purebloods, who lived in a Chinese world, linguistically and culturally, and separate from the social worlds of either the Indonesians or the Peranakans. The split between the Peranakans and the Totoks has been an enduring one, but the passing years have changed the relative proportions of the two groups. As of 1920, 70% of the Chinese population were Peranakans, but by 1950, this had dropped to approximately 60%. Although these two groups were initially defined in terms of racially mixed versus racially unmixed ancestry, over the years, the terms have come to be used in social and cultural senses rather than in strictly racial, citizenship, or generational senses. During the interwar period, A leading Chinese newspaper in the East Indies was published in the Malay language for the Peranakans and in Chinese for the Totoks, and with differing proportions of news items relating to the Indies and to China. Peranakans and Totoks also had different political organizations with conflicting goals. To the indigenous Indonesians, however, both were Chinese, and neither were welcome as full-fledged members of the Indonesian nationalist movement trying to secure independence from Dutch rule. Indonesian nationalists tended to be defined in racial terms. Moreover, many Chinese were well aware of the envy and hostility of the Indonesians, and some Chinese openly preferred the continuance of Dutch rule, although others were sympathetic to Indonesian nationalism, while still others saw no reason to take sides and many dangers in doing so. Economic differences between the Chinese and the Indonesians were very large. In 1939, there were more Chinese than Indonesians in the top income bracket in absolute numbers, even though the Chinese were a small minority in the population. Most Chinese were in the middle income bracket, while more than four-fifths of the Europeans were in the top bracket. But with more than two-thirds of the Indonesians in the bottom bracket, the Chinese looked rich. Moreover, they were a safer target to attack, both politically and in terms of violence. As elsewhere in Southeast Asia, the presence of the colonial power protected the Chinese to some extent, but the early World War II victories of the Japanese jeopardized them. When it became clear, after the Japanese invasion, that there was no longer anyone to protect the Chinese, first criminals and then the general population in Java began to rob, murder, and rape in the Chinese community. As in Thailand and Malaysia, the Chinese were generally pro-Western during the war, while the native peoples were generally pro-Japanese, though there were also some Chinese collaborators and some Indonesians who did not collaborate. Neither the Japanese during the war nor the Indonesians after the war paid much attention to the distinction between Totok and Peranakan Chinese. In the confusion following the surrender of Japan, when Indonesian nationalists proclaimed independence while the Dutch returned to re-establish colonial rule, the Chinese attempted to be neutral but were in various places assaulted by Indonesians. In 1946, some of the most assimilated Chinese, who had lived peacefully with the Indonesians for years, were slaughtered by the hundreds in the suburbs of Tangerang. More massacres followed in other places. Altogether, an estimated 1,000 Chinese were killed and 100,000 made homeless. More died in the military conflicts between Indonesian and Dutch military forces, particularly at the hands of Indonesian guerrillas. Nor were the Chinese population's troubles over when peace returned as an independent Indonesia was declared in 1949. There were more than 2 million Chinese in newly independent Indonesia, nearly three-quarters of whom were born there. Yet that did not automatically make them citizens. As late as the mid-1960s, less than half the Chinese in Indonesia were citizens. Partly this reflected the complexities of international relations involving Communist China, the Chinese nationalist government on Taiwan, and Indonesia, for China had long claimed overseas Chinese as its own citizens, and new treaties were required to remove ambiguities on this point. More fundamentally, however, the problem was a reluctance of Indonesians to grant automatic citizenship to the Chinese born on their soil, and the reluctance of some Chinese to seek a citizenship which would not mean equal treatment in Indonesia, but only a cutting off of ties with China. Informed estimates of the Chinese who rejected Indonesian citizenship ranged from 10% in Semarang to 25% in Jakarta. The fears of the Chinese that they would receive only second-class citizenship were amply confirmed by a series of laws distinguishing indigenous Indonesians from citizens of foreign ancestry, or citizens with dual citizenship. For example, import licenses, government credit, and other privileges were reserved for national importers, in practice, indigenous Indonesians, as distinguished from citizens of non-indigenous origin, such as the Chinese. Alien Chinese, who included people born in Indonesia but not Indonesian citizens, were even more discriminated against. They were banned from operating retail businesses in small towns or villages, or owning rice mills. People with both Indonesian citizenship and other citizenship were banned from another range of economic activities, a blow at those Chinese whose status remained unclear as China and Indonesia negotiated a citizenship treaty. Accompanying these and many other economic constraints on the Chinese were numerous restrictions on the publication of Chinese language newspapers and magazines, or the operation of private Chinese schools. Reactions among the Chinese were varied. More than 100,000 simply left Indonesia in 1960, and much Chinese-owned capital also flowed out of the country. Others operated businesses behind Indonesian frontmen who officially held the required licenses. This became such a widespread and widely known phenomenon that such businesses were known, as in Malaysia, as Alibaba Enterprises, Ali being the Indonesian front and Baba the Chinese actually owning and operating the business. Yet another strategy was for Chinese businessmen to contribute to influential or powerful government officials to get the rules bent, suspended, or ignored, or even to receive government contracts and favors. In a variety of ways, the Chinese accommodated themselves to what Indonesian President Sukarno called the New Order, and Sukarno in turn began to moderate the anti-Chinese policies in Indonesia while seeking closer international ties with China. The government was also aware that the full implementation of its proclaimed intention to indigenize business ownership would damage an economy already suffering from many problems. However, the failure to do so and the continuing prosperity of many Chinese created public discontent, often manipulated by enemies of the regime, leading increasingly in 1963 to outbreaks of anti-Chinese violence in various parts of the country. Most politically active Chinese came eventually to support Sukarno's left-wing pro-China government and suffered greatly in the violent backlash in 1965 that brought to power a conservative military government headed by General Suharto. Anti-Chinese violence erupted sporadically, and demands for stronger anti-Chinese policies were almost constant during the first 2 years after the military accession to power. However, by the end of 1967, both the political and the violent phases of anti-Chinese activity were in retreat. While making token concessions to the more extreme anti-Chinese elements, notably Muslim business rivals and Indonesian university students, the Suharto government held fast against demands that would have crippled the economy by forcing Chinese businessmen to abandon economic activities for which there were not enough indigenous substitutes. Some previously nationalized Chinese enterprises were returned to their owners after 1967. As elsewhere in Southeast Asia, Chinese businessmen in Indonesia attempted to buy security by various forms of payoffs to Indonesian officials, ranging from common soldiers to the highest levels of government. This was a continuation of a long-standing pattern, antedating the Suharto government. The price of peace for the Chinese went beyond money. They had to accept the government's banning of most of their cultural, social, and political organizations as part of a general policy of pressure toward assimilation, one of the remarkable features of which was the mass changing of Chinese names to Indonesian names individually and voluntarily, but under pressure. Despite such attempts at accommodation, riots against the Chinese continued to break out sporadically during the 1970s and 1980s. The Chinese in Indonesia have long been considered the most assimilated Chinese community in Southeast Asia, but this has not prevented them from being also the most repeatedly and violently attacked. A large community in absolute numbers, 4 million people in the late 20th century, the Chinese in Indonesia were less than 3% of the country's population, while the 4.3 million Chinese in neighboring Malaysia constituted 29% of that country's total population. Neither assimilation nor inconspicuous size has spared the Chinese the dire consequences of envy, resentment, and the politicization of race. The Philippines. The Chinese population of the Philippines has historically been one of the smallest in any Southeast Asian nation, both absolutely and relative to the general population. In the middle of the 20th century, the Chinese population of the Philippines was estimated at less than 250,000 people, about 1/12 that of the Chinese population in Thailand, and only 1% of the total Philippine population. By the late 20th century, there were an estimated 700,000 Chinese in the Philippines, not quite 1.5% of the total population. The extreme smallness of the Chinese minority in the Philippines makes their historic role in the development of the Philippine economy all the more remarkable. European colonialism and large-scale immigration of Chinese both came to the Philippines somewhat earlier than in some other parts of the Far East. There were Chinese already living in the Philippines before the arrival of the Spaniards in the 16th century, and there were many more when Spanish rule came to an end 4 centuries later. However, there were highly variable estimates of how many Chinese lived in the Philippines at many points in between. There were enough, however, for several thousand Chinese to be killed by the Spaniards on each of 3 occasions when revolts were drowned in blood during the 17th century. In addition to the resident Chinese, there were traders from China who came and went, supplying a variety of commodities. The Chinese were also the principal laborers and artisans in the country, and built many churches, forts, and convents that remained standing as late as the Second World War. The Chinese were also bakers, porters, tailors, shoemakers, locksmiths, weavers, and worked in other trades. Moreover, they produced goods at low prices. The economic success of the Chinese aroused not only the usual envy and resentment, but also, in this age of mercantilism, fears that gold was being drained away to China. In the Philippines, as elsewhere in Southeast Asia during the colonial era, the Chinese were often sojourners rather than settlers. They came to earn money with which to return to China, whether or not they actually achieved their goals, and regardless of whether the goal itself changed over the years. Many left families behind, to whom they returned, but some brought their families over to join them in the Philippines. During the late 19th century, from 10,000 to 12,000 Chinese arrived in Manila annually, and 7,000 to 8,000 departed for China. The resident Chinese population in the Philippines grew to about 40,000 by the end of the Spanish colonial period, just over half concentrated in Manila. Most of the Chinese of this era were uneducated males, but the Chinese dominated both wholesale and retail trade. Chinese domination of skilled occupations lasted for centuries. Even as late as the early 20th century, American businessmen in the Philippines were pressing for allowing immigration from China because of insufficient skilled labor among the Filipinos. Because the Chinese were prominent in skilled and entrepreneurial roles did not mean that most Chinese worked in such occupations. Many were coolies doing simple arduous labor. However, the change to American rule in the Philippines after the Spanish-American War meant that American restrictions on Chinese coolie immigration now applied. Thereafter, the Chinese who came to the Philippines tended to be tradesmen. Here, as elsewhere in the world, the Chinese shopkeeper became known for his hard work, long hours, and frugality. The Chinese community, or rather communities, split along lines deriving from their places of origin in China, was also noted for supplying credit and other aid to newcomers from the homeland. During the period of American colonial rule in the Philippines, Chinese investments grew to become second only to U.S. investments. The Chinese also conducted about 3/4 of all retail trade and owned about 3/4 of all the rice mills in the Philippines. However, this did not mean that affluence was common among the Chinese in the Philippines. The average Chinese shop was described as a miserable little shack, smelly and containing a small inventory. Nevertheless, it was enough to inspire envy among Filipinos who had less, and who were often in debt to the Chinese storekeeper or other middleman. After the Philippines became an autonomous commonwealth in 1935, it began to pass discriminatory legislation restricting the economic activities of the Chinese and creating government-subsidized Filipino competition. By 1939, according to Philippine President Manuel Quezon, the Filipino share of retail trade had risen from its previous 15% to 20% to 37%. Quezon tried to moderate anti-Chinese feeling in the Philippines by pointing out that the Chinese have helped in the development of our country when our own people were not engaging in business enterprises. There were fewer barriers to intermarriage between the Filipinos and Chinese under the Catholic religion and Spanish rule than to intermarriage in Muslim Malaysia, for example. Moreover, these Chinese Filipino mestizos were more readily merged with the general Filipino population than were the mixed populations of Malaysia or Indonesia. The mestizos of the Philippines have been characterized as one of the most capable, prosperous, and powerful elements of the Filipino people. Even after a massive increase of immigration from China under American colonial rule, the mestizos still greatly outnumbered the ethnically Chinese. By the 1940s, there were about 750,000 mestizos. Some of those who entered politics were among the most strongly anti-Chinese elements in the Philippines. The Chinese community in the Philippines evolved socially as well as economically. With the passing years, more and more Chinese women immigrated into the Philippines, reducing the vast sex imbalance and creating a purely Chinese generation of substantial size for the first time. While there were still 5 Chinese men for every Chinese woman in the Philippines as late as 1933, this was less than half the ratio just 15 years earlier, and the ratio continued declining over the years. The second generation Chinese were raised in a Chinese culture. By 1935, there were 58 Chinese schools in the Philippines, enrolling more than 7,000 students. Nevertheless, this second generation also acquired Filipino culture and, unlike their parents, had never seen China and were unlikely to be able to visit it as war raged there for more than a decade. Moreover, after the Philippines gained complete independence in 1946, a renewed series of laws discriminating against aliens prompted many second-generation Chinese to seek Filipino citizenship, despite the costs and difficulties of doing so. There were many influences tending to bring Filipinos and Chinese closer together, as well as other influences tending to pull them apart. The fact that so many of the Chinese in the countryside lived surrounded by Filipinos meant that they, and especially their children, tended to acquire local languages, customs, and attitudes. The experiences of the two groups during World War II also tended to bring them closer together. Unlike the situation in other Southeast Asian nations, both the Filipinos and the Chinese opposed the Japanese invaders of the Philippines. Both remained loyal to the Allied cause, and Filipinos often helped the Chinese hide out from the Japanese occupation authorities. In the post-war era, the civil war in China prompted the Philippine government to suspend immigration from that country to avoid being swamped by refugees. This had the side effect of making the Chinese population of the Philippines one that was increasingly Philippine-born and bred, without an influx of new Chinese to replace the older generation of China-born people as they died out. Moreover, intermarriage between Chinese and Filipinos continued. In the middle of the 20th century, nearly 1/4 of all marriages of Chinese males were with Filipino women. In addition, common law relationships were widespread, especially among lower-level merchants, many of whom operated behind the facade of the woman's Philippine citizenship and ostensible ownership to evade anti-alien laws and restrictions aimed at the Chinese. Marriages between Filipino males and Chinese females remained extremely rare, however. Social interactions in general between Chinese and Filipinos tended to be greater in the provinces, where the Chinese had been more thinly spread among the indigenous population, while in Manila, the large Chinese community has been more self-sufficient in its social and cultural life. As of 1958, for example, there were 36 Chinese schools in and around Manila, with approximately 23,000 students. Through all the changes in the country, the Chinese remained a middleman minority. By the late 20th century, more than 4/5 of all adult Chinese males in the Philippines owned and operated some kind of business. These were by no means all large or even prosperous businesses, and failure rates were high. Nevertheless, the Chinese community was essentially a business community. With the severe restrictions imposed on immigration after World War II, and with the virtual severance of ties with China by the Philippine Chinese after the communists took power in 1949, the Chinese community in the Philippines now had its roots locally, though its culture, and especially its economic patterns, remained distinctively Chinese. The more successful found it expedient to establish relationships with Filipinos in high places for political protection from discriminatory laws and policies. Indochina. Chinese influence in the Indochina region goes back to the ancient Han dynasty, which was contemporaneous with the Roman Empire. The relationships of China with this region were military, economic, and cultural. The Han dynasty established a military garrison in Hanoi, for example, and cultural artifacts from ancient China have been found not only in Indochina, but also as far away as Borneo, Java, and Sumatra. It was 939 AD before Vietnam freed itself from China, and it remained independent except for the epoch of Mongol rule, until it was again briefly part of the Chinese Empire during the early Ming Dynasty. All in all, Vietnam was under Chinese rule for more than 1,000 years. Cambodia recognized Chinese suzerainty in the Tang Dynasty of the 7th century. China also traded extensively with the Indochina region, as it did with other parts of Asia and with Europe and the Western Hemisphere. At this juncture, China was an exporter of finished products and an importer of raw material. New strains of rice imported from Vietnam during the Sung Dynasty greatly improved rice production in China. In later centuries, the Indochina region also became a refuge for the defeated Chinese supporters of fallen dynasties. Indochina derived its name from its geographical location between the great civilizations of India and of China, and its history has reflected the cultural influence of both. Chinese culture remained particularly influential, even after Chinese rule was thrown off or tribute paid to China discontinued. Chinese populations in the Indochina region long antedated French colonial rule. The indigenous peoples of Indochina were far from being homogeneous or harmonious among themselves, and their reactions to the Chinese also varied greatly. Hostility between Cambodia's Khmer people and the Vietnamese, for example, goes back for centuries and has historically been greater than that between the Khmer and the Chinese. While the Vietnamese massacred more than 10,000 Chinese in a community near Saigon in the 18th century, Cambodia had no such history of anti-Chinese hostility as that in Vietnam, and in fact, relations between the Khmer and the Chinese were generally amicable, with significant intermarriage. French colonial rule in Indochina began in the mid-19th century and lasted until just after the middle of the 20th century. Under the French, the Chinese population of the region grew rapidly, despite various efforts of the French authorities to restrict their immigration. By 1931, there were approximately 418,000 Chinese in Indochina. Around the middle of the century, there were nearly this many Chinese in the Saigon-Chalon area alone, more than 800,000 in South Vietnam altogether, as well as an estimated 50,000 to 60,000 in North Vietnam, 40,000 in Laos, and 218,000 in Cambodia. These are all estimates, and, in the absence of official census data, different estimates have varied considerably. What has been consistent among the estimates is that 1. South Vietnam contained the largest concentration of Chinese, with Cambodia next, and 2. The Chinese in all these countries were less than 10% of the population. This small Chinese minority played a disproportionately large role in the economies of Indochina. They owned approximately 70% of small-scale industry in Laos and conducted more than 70% of the retail trade in Vietnam and Cambodia. In South Vietnam in 1974, the Chinese owned 60% of all capital invested in paper manufacturing and in fisheries, and 80% of all capital invested in the manufacturing of textiles, iron and steel, and chemical and allied products. This reflected a long history of Chinese businessmen in Indochina being too much competition for both the indigenous businessmen and for the French. The Annamites and Cambodians, for example, lacked the frugality and perseverance of the Chinese in business, and Annamite fishermen were neither as efficient nor as venturesome as Chinese fishermen who fished on the open seas while the Annamites fished only the coastal waters. The French were unable or unwilling to live as cheaply as the Chinese, to accept as low a rate of profit, or to learn the local languages and cultures as a way of facilitating business transactions. Therefore, the Chinese acted as middlemen, not only in the sense of being intermediaries in the economic chain of transactions, but also in the sense of being intermediaries between the French and indigenous races. The Chinese also undersold the French businessmen selling to the French government during the colonial era. The effectiveness of the Chinese in extending credit to each other and to the local population depended upon extensive, first-hand knowledge of the individual recipients, rather than simply on such objective data as financial assets. This meant, among other things, that the Chinese could generally lend to each other at lower rates of interest than to Vietnamese businessmen, and in turn, the Chinese could sell with smaller profit margins and more liberal credit terms to customers than the Vietnamese businessmen could. In Cambodia, the Chinese dominated commercial gardening and truck farming around the country's urban centers, and dominated the cultivation of pepper from before the French came until the guerrilla warfare of the post-war era made it too hazardous. On the eve of World War II, the Chinese owned and operated 23 out of 27 large, mechanized rice processing mills in the main coastal port cities, as well as being prominent in a wide range of commercial and industrial enterprises, ranging from distilleries to shipbuilding. Indochina escaped direct Japanese occupation during most of World War II because it was run by the Vichy regime in France, which was collaborating with Japan's ally, Nazi Germany. In the last year of the war, and for decades into the post-war era, Indochina became a battleground where, at various times and places, troops of the communist-led insurgents, the Chinese nationalists, Kuomintang, the British, the French, and eventually the Americans, fought over the destiny of this strategically located country. As French Indochina disappeared, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos went their separate ways as independent states. All discriminated against the Chinese with laws forbidding them to engage in many occupations. When the communists established control in these states during the 1970s, the Chinese were doubly hated as capitalists and doubly targeted for oppression. Of the 1 million refugees who fled Vietnam between 1975 and 1979, an estimated 70% were Chinese. Many were boat people who often put themselves and their families on flimsy and leaking river craft and took the desperate gamble of setting sail on the high seas, where hundreds of thousands drowned. Many boat people were also victimized on the high seas by crews of other vessels who boarded their defenseless boats to rob, rape, and murder the hated Chinese. After 1979, the exodus declined but did not stop. With the communist takeover of Cambodia, renamed Kampuchea, a new wave of mass barbarities fostered a new wave of refugees, sometimes called land people, who tried to escape across the land to Thailand. Many were killed on the way. Those who remained were caught in the greatest mass murders of the post-war era by communist leader Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge troops. Half of Kampuchea's Chinese population of 400,000 were killed during the 1975-79 period. They were only part of the millions slaughtered in the infamous killing fields of Kampuchea. China, which protested vehemently about Indonesia's mistreatment of its Chinese minority, made no such protests over what was happening in Kampuchea. Pol Pot was an ally. The Western Hemisphere. The immigration of Chinese to the Western Hemisphere does not go back as many centuries as their immigration to Southeast Asia, nor has it involved as large numbers. Yet some aspects of the economic and social patterns of the overseas Chinese have reappeared, adapted to local circumstances. Significant Chinese immigration to the Western Hemisphere dates generally from the middle of the 19th century, though about 200 were brought to Trinidad experimentally in 1806 by the British. That most Chinese immigrants to Southeast Asia should have come from China's southern provinces seems explainable by geographical proximity, but that the same should be true of Chinese immigrants to the Caribbean and the United States suggests that geography was hardly the only factor. Virtually all the Chinese immigrants to Cuba came from southern China, with 41% coming from the Toshan district alone, which also supplied a majority of the Chinese immigrants to the United States prior to World War I. Internal distinctions among the Chinese have persisted in the Western Hemisphere, as in Southeast Asia. The Cantonese and the Hakkas, for example, have remained residentially and socially separate throughout the Caribbean region, despite the small size of the Chinese communities there. Moreover, their usual destinations have differed as well. The former have tended to re-emigrate from British Guiana to Suriname, the latter to Trinidad. In the United States, the post-war Hong Kong Chinese immigrants remained socially and economically quite distinct from the Chinese whose forebears immigrated largely before World War I. Chinese communities of various sizes have been scattered throughout the Western Hemisphere, from Canada to Argentina. Chinese laborers helped build the Panama Canal, and many remained to engage in retail trade, setting up grocery stores and dry goods stores, as well as restaurants and coffee shops. By the middle of the 20th century, there were more than 5,000 Chinese in Brazil, including some who operated factories and engaged in the import and export trade. In Ecuador, the Chinese owned the largest rice mill in the country. The Chinese in Canada have had a history very much like that of the Chinese in the United States, including both their oppressions and exclusions on the one hand, and their eventual emergence as a prosperous and respected community on the other. One sign of changed times was a 1957 upset victory in a Canadian parliamentary election by a Chinese candidate who defeated an incumbent minister. In much of the Western Hemisphere, however, the Chinese went through many vicissitudes before achieving such general acceptance. The Caribbean and South America. Perhaps the most tragic of all immigrations from China have been those of the coolie trade from the Portuguese-held port of Macau to the Western Hemisphere in the 19th century. These Chinese coolies, or immigrant laborers, have been described as more slaves than immigrants, for many of these nominally free immigrants were in fact prisoners from the time they were locked into holding compounds in Macau until they completed years of contract labor under brutal conditions in Cuba, Peru, or other destinations in Latin America. While some of these poor and often illiterate Chinese came voluntarily, others were gotten into the compounds by trickery, drugs, or force. Once inside, they had little chance of escape, though many were judged physically unfit and let go. But those retained from Macau's coolie trade faced years without freedom, during which they were subject to flogging and other punishments. Inside the Macau compounds, Chinese men could be seen dripping with blood, the result of chastisements. Legal formalities of contract were observed, but under conditions that made a mockery of the process. Fortunately, not all Chinese immigrants to the Western Hemisphere embarked from Macau, nor were they all in the semi-slave condition of those who did. Although the term coolie was applied to immigrant Chinese laborers in general, not all came as indentured workers. Most Chinese who immigrated to the United States, for example, did not. Moreover, as the horrors of the semi-slave trade became known in China and the West, various nations began to forbid their ships to engage in it. The British closed the port of Hong Kong to this trade, as China closed its ports and made the recruiters or kidnappers subject to beheading, while some were lynched by angry Chinese mobs. By 1859, only the Portuguese port of Macau on the South China coast continued to carry on this kind of coolie trade. But through Macau, hundreds of thousands of Chinese were shipped to the Western Hemisphere. In the quarter of a century beginning in 1849, approximately 90,000 Chinese were shipped from Macau to Peru, and for the period 1847 to 1874, an estimated 125,000 were shipped to Cuba. Most never saw China again, and many did not live to complete their terms of indenture, though they were sent as young men in their prime. A majority of those sent to Cuba died before completing the 8 years of their labor contracts. The high death rates were due to unhealthy living conditions, brutal working conditions, and suicides. The suicides began in the holding compounds in Macau, continued during the long voyage to the Americas, and after the Chinese were placed on plantations as laborers. In 19th century Cuba, there were years when more than 100 Chinese committed suicide. In Peru, guards were posted to prevent suicide among the Chinese performing the grueling task of shoveling bird manure into sacks for export as fertilizer under stifling heat and stench. The ships that carried the Chinese coolies from Macau to the Caribbean and South America were set up as floating prisons, with barred doors and cannon pointed at those doors. Packed in like sardines in filthy conditions for a voyage that took 4 months to Peru, many Chinese died en route. For the period 1860 to 1870, more than 4,600 died out of a total of 43,000 shipped to the Peruvian port of Callao. Earlier death rates were higher. Among Cuban-bound vessels that landed in Havana from 1847 to 1859, there were more than 7,700 deaths among 50,000 coolies who embarked from China. These mortality figures from the ports of arrival do not include deaths on ships that never reached their destinations, whether because of natural or man-made disasters. There were also many mutinies among the Chinese, and those that succeeded forced the ships to turn back to China, so the mortality figures do not include those who died in the bloody battles for control of those ships. The mortality rates to Cuba and Peru were not due merely to the general conditions of voyages at that time. For British ships carrying Chinese laborers from Canton and Hong Kong to British Guiana during the same era averaged far lower mortality rates. In Peru, more than 90% of the men worked on the huge plantations run by wealthy Peruvian landowners, some of whom would buy an entire shipload of coolies at a time. Here, too, they were locked up and subjected to flogging, among other punishments. Their contracts gave them 3 days off per year for Chinese New Year celebrations. There were from time to time escapes and riots by the Chinese, and in 1870, a major uprising of more than 1,000 coolies who went on a rampage, spreading beyond the plantations into nearby communities, committing rape and murder. In the end, the uprising was suppressed, with 150 deaths among the Chinese and 16 among the whites. The whole system of importation of indentured coolies from Macau was ended in 1874. The life of the Chinese in Cuba was not very different, and the end of the coolie trade from Macau came the same year. The Cubans also flogged the Chinese, with this refinement. A current practice was that of obliging the victim to count the lashes himself. If in his agony he lost count, the result could be to his disadvantage. A contemporary Cuban journalist who observed the plantation declared, "There is no pretense on the part of anyone to regard them in any other light than as slaves." While Chinese in the Western Hemisphere in general were not treated in such a horrifying way as in Cuba and Peru, their lives were at best arduous throughout the Americas. Yet by the end of the 19th century, the Chinese were starting their economic rise from very lowly beginnings. As of 1899, there were more than 8,000 Chinese day laborers in Cuba and more than 2,700 servants, but also nearly 2,000 merchants. Many of these were itinerant peddlers or proprietors of small eating places. The Chinese had become predominant in the growing and selling of vegetables in Cuba and owned many grocery stores. In Peru, the descendants of the coolies came eventually to own more than half the grocery stores in the capital city of Lima. Because there were no Chinese women sent to Peru, the men married Peruvian women when they could, producing offspring with a combination of Chinese, American Indian, and Caucasian ancestry. Although most immigrant groups tend to increase in population size over the generations, the Chinese population in the Western Hemisphere declined substantially in various countries. During the 19th century, 125,000 Chinese went to Cuba as contract laborers in one generation, but there were only 14,000 Chinese living there in the middle of the 20th century. In British Guiana, nearly 16,000 Chinese arrived over a period of 60 years, but fewer than 3,000 remained as of 1911. In the United States, the Chinese population exceeded 100,000 in 1890, but was down to about 60,000 by 1920. Among the causes for the decline of the Chinese population, a massive sex imbalance was clearly of major importance, but was not necessarily decisive, for there was also a large sex imbalance among the Chinese population in Jamaica, which nevertheless grew more or less steadily over the years. But a large sex imbalance in countries where marriage with the women of other races was rare had very different consequences than in Jamaica, where Chinese intermarriage was widespread. Decimation by death in the prime of life was another factor, especially in countries like Cuba or Peru, where brutal working and living conditions took a toll. Little of the declining Chinese population can be attributed to people returning to China, because this seldom happened. largely due to the utter inability of most coolies to save enough money to finance a voyage back across the Pacific. For better or worse, the fate of the Chinese immigrants to the Western Hemisphere now lay in the Western Hemisphere. While Cuba and Peru stand out for the special criminality and brutality with which they brought masses of Chinese to the Western Hemisphere, the principal occupation of the Chinese upon arrival was very much the same: agricultural laborers, whether in Cuba and Peru or in Jamaica, Trinidad, Suriname, British Guiana, or other countries in the Caribbean and South America. Yet in later years, the Chinese have emerged as shopkeepers throughout the region. So dominant did the Chinese become as retailers that grocery stores in the area were called generically China shops. They also became prominent in other kinds of retailing. In Peru, Chinese merchants were noted for selling at cheaper prices. In Chile, by 1914, there were 456 businesses owned by a Chinese population of only a few thousand people. By 1943, nearly two-thirds of the Chinese working in British Guiana were in retailing. The Chinese also became dominant in the retail trade in Jamaica, where they were less than 1% of the population. The competition faced by the Chinese in retailing in the West Indies came principally from such other international middleman minorities as the East Indians, the Jews, and the Portuguese, rather than from West Indian Creoles. Even the elite among the Creole Jamaicans and Trinidadians tended to shun entrepreneurial activity in favor of the professions and politics. As in other parts of the world, the Chinese tended to ignore local politics in the West Indies. By 1943, there were more than 12,000 Chinese in Jamaica, nearly half of whom were colored Chinese of mixed ancestry. By 1960, this had grown to nearly 22,000 Chinese, again nearly half being colored Chinese. With the passing years, the proportion of the Jamaica Chinese born in China declined from more than one-fifth in 1943 to less than one-tenth by 1960. The sex ratio had become virtually even by 1960, as compared to a 5-to-1 male predominance in 1911. As a proportion of the total population of Jamaica, the Chinese were just over 1%. In Guyana, the Chinese are just under 1%. There were about 3,000 Chinese in Suriname. In Trinidad, the Chinese were also less than 1% of the population and numbered about 8,000. Yet, they have historically played a major role in the development of the distribution of goods at the retail level throughout the West Indies. As elsewhere, the Chinese in the Caribbean were highly urbanized. More than one-third of the Chinese in Trinidad lived in the capital city and principal seaport, Port of Spain. Precisely because they were so small a portion of the population and politically uninvolved, the Chinese have been entrusted with mediating roles in Trinidad and Guyana, where hostility between blacks and East Indians caused each group to distrust the other. The first president of Guyana was Chinese, as was the first governor general of Trinidad. The same characteristics associated with the Chinese elsewhere were widely noted of them in the Caribbean: the central role of the family, frugality, social separateness, even when culturally assimilated, and a willingness to sacrifice the present for the future. Although the Chinese in the West Indies became largely Creoles in terms of external culture, their values and prosperity were distinctive. Not only were the Chinese more entrepreneurial, they were also better educated. In Jamaica and Trinidad, a higher proportion of the Chinese than of any of the other ethnic groups attended secondary school. Chinese were therefore overrepresented in the professions and civil service, as well as in business. In mid-20th century Jamaica, the average income of the Chinese was 3 times that of colored Jamaicans and 5 times that of black Jamaicans. Residentially, the Chinese in the West Indies tended to be widely scattered, partly because their retail stores served many areas. The more prosperous later generations often lived in white upper-class neighborhoods in and around the respective capital cities of Trinidad, Jamaica, Guyana, and Suriname. In the earlier years, intermarriage between Chinese men and colored women was commonplace around the Caribbean when the largely male Chinese first arrived, so that racially mixed Chinese were almost as numerous as pure Chinese in the Caribbean, and as socially accepted in the Chinese community. Nevertheless, the Chinese remained outside the value system of West Indian society, unaffected by its Creole patterns of conspicuous consumption, distribution of largesse, forgiveness of debts, and other traits that operate against business success. The social sanctions of Creole society were ineffective against the Chinese, who, in a fundamental value sense, lived outside that society, even when located in it, exhibiting its outward manifestations in language, food, and clothing, or even a degree of biological amalgamation. The great prominence of the Chinese in retailing provoked the same social hostility and political antagonism in the Caribbean as in Southeast Asia. There were sporadic outbreaks of destruction of Chinese shops by mobs and arson at various times in the history of Jamaica, including a 1965 riot in which Chinese shops were looted and burned after an accusation that a black employee had been mistreated by a Chinese employer. Decisions by Chinese West Indian umpires in international cricket matches have also set off riots in Trinidad, Guyana, and Jamaica. These were simply sparks that ignited combustible emotions. However, the anti-Chinese hostility of the Caribbean has apparently been far less than in Southeast Asia. This may be due to the generally more relaxed racial feelings in the region, or to the existence of other middleman minorities there who are more numerous, the East Indians, or more prominent, the Jews, and who serve as alternative targets of local envy and resentment. The United States. The first documented record of a Chinese person in the United States goes back to the 18th century, and there have been claims of Chinese being in the area that is now the United States even earlier. However, large-scale immigration of Chinese began around the middle of the 19th century in response to the discovery of gold in California. Between 1850 and 1882, when American legislation abruptly cut off immigration from China, more than 322,000 Chinese entered the United States. However, the resident Chinese population remained far below that number in the 19th century, as many immigrants returned to China. As of 1880, there were approximately 105,000 Chinese in the United States, and 107,000 in 1890, before a long decline in the Chinese population to 62,000 in 1920. Partly, these numbers reflected the continuing return of immigrants to China, while replacements were forbidden to enter the United States. Partly, too, it reflected a lopsided imbalance between males and females among the Chinese immigrants, a ratio of about 19 to 1 in 1860, rising to a peak of nearly 27 to 1 by 1890. Few Chinese men remained in the United States long enough, or prospered well enough, to bring over their wives from China before the Chinese Exclusion Act went into effect in 1882, though more than one-fourth of them had wives. Indeed, many Chinese men did not prosper well enough to be able to return to China and were permanently cut off from wives and children on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. This was a particularly bitter blow to a people so family-centered as the Chinese. Many lived out their lives as lonely and destitute men in a country where there was little hope of intermarriage. With very few Chinese marriages and very few Chinese children being born to replace the older generation as they died off, the Chinese population of the United States continued to decline for decades. There was little to indicate that this tragic fate was in store when the first Chinese immigrants landed in the mid-19th century and were largely welcomed by Americans. However, these first few Chinese were predominantly prosperous merchants, along with skilled artisans, fishermen, and hotel and restaurant owners. Race alone was not enough to bar them from participation in municipal festivities and ceremonies in San Francisco. It was when a much larger mass of coolie laborers arrived from China that American attitudes became negative and hostile. However, this change did not happen all at once. During the first few years, the Chinese workers were welcomed by the public, by government officials, and especially by employers, for the Chinese were noted for their hard work and dependability. The concentration of this coolie immigration in time and space added to its shock. By 1851, there were 25,000 Chinese working in California. They were concentrated in and around San Francisco and out in the Gold Rush region about 100 miles to the east. Several thousand Chinese clustered together here and there in the Gold Rush country in 1852, working hard and living frugally, both patterns being in sharp contrast with the patterns among the rowdy masses of American gold seekers around them. Many of these Americans were Southern whites, who constituted about one-third of the vast numbers of men attracted by California gold. The virulent racial attitudes they brought with them from the antebellum South were felt in both laws and attitudes in California in the years that followed. Blacks, as well as Chinese, suffered from adverse changes in the racial atmosphere in mid-century California. The Chinese not only mined gold, both for themselves and as employees of mining companies, but also worked as cooks, peddlers, and storekeepers in the motherlode country. Discriminatory laws and practices, the latter often backed by violence that was endemic in Gold Rush communities, forced many Chinese out of direct competition with white miners. However, the Chinese were allowed into some areas abandoned by white miners as unprofitable. Here, the remarkable patience of the Chinese often paid off as they carefully panned the streams and painstakingly picked through the dust to find bits of gold overlooked by the disappointed white miners. Tremendous amounts of gold came out of California and later Nevada in the Gold Rush years. The large element of luck made these years of fabulous wealth and dire poverty among gold miners, the latter predominating. How the Chinese in particular fared economically is not known directly. However, as a group, in 1876 alone, they sent an estimated $11 million back to Kwantung Province, where nearly all the Chinese in the United States originated, making it one of the most prosperous and modernized provinces in China. A high personal price was paid by the Chinese immigrants, however. Many failed in the search for gold or ended up in poverty, and many were killed in the violent frontier area. 88 were reported as murdered in 1862 alone. Even those who employed Chinese workers were sometimes targets of violence. The Gold Rush changed San Francisco from a little town with about 1,000 people, including troops stationed there, to a city to rival those of the East Coast in population and wealth. It too was a violent place, both in terms of murders and vigilante retribution. This was the home of more than half the Chinese in the United States in the 1850s. The Chinese in 19th century San Francisco engaged in a wide range of occupations. In 1850, when there were only about 700 Chinese in the city, they owned restaurants, laundries, and shops. An area known as Little Canton had 33 retail stores, 15 pharmacies, and 5 restaurants, serving both Chinese and non-Chinese customers. By 1870, there were about 2,000 Chinese laundries dominating this trade in San Francisco. The Chinese were also the main providers of firewood and supplied fruit, vegetables, and flowers. They were also in great demand as domestic servants and were widely used in construction work, ranging from landfill operations and street grading, which created many parts of San Francisco as it is today, to stonemasonry and other artisan work that erected the first stone building in the city, with stone imported from China. With the passing years, the Chinese spread out somewhat geographically and diversified occupationally during the 19th century. The building of the Transcontinental Railroad alone ultimately employed more than one-fourth of all the Chinese in the country. In the course of this backbreaking and dangerous work of building a railroad across rugged mountains, more than 1,000 Chinese ended up with their bones being shipped back to China to be buried. However, when the president of the Central Pacific Railroad, Leland Stanford, was photographed in 1869 driving the historic Golden Spike connecting the eastern and western United States by rail, none of those in the famous picture taken at Promontory Point was Chinese, even though 9/10 of the 14,000 railroad workers on the Central Pacific side were Chinese. However, their contribution was publicly acknowledged that day and later. As in other countries around the world, the Chinese in the United States encountered growing resentment from those unable to compete with them. This began as early as the beginning of the 1850s among white laborers. Miners in the Gold Rush region took the law into their own hands early on, driving the Chinese out of various mining areas with violence. For decades, violent attacks continued sporadically, usually by white workers, urban and agricultural. As the California Gold Rush tapered off, many Chinese sought work in new occupations and communities, and their success quickly provoked backlashes from white workers, and then, as the Chinese went into business for themselves, from white businessmen and small farmers. Large landowners who hired many Chinese coolies lined up politically against a growing list of anti-Chinese legislation, as did the railroads and other large white-owned businesses with many Chinese workers. Politically, however, the anti-Chinese forces prevailed as laws excluded or harassed the Chinese from industry after industry. Mob violence against the Chinese, or against those hiring Chinese, exploded in communities across the state. The physical violence was successful in forcing employers to stop hiring Chinese. Organized labor unions were especially prominent in anti-Chinese agitation and politically. Numerous anti-Chinese laws in California were capped by a federal law cutting off further immigration from China. Before being forced out, the Chinese had been the majority of the workforce in some industries and localities. At one time, they were more than four-fifths of all agricultural workers in California, including vineyard workers. They were half the workforce in the California shrimp fishing industry, and received five-sixths of the payroll of the Columbia River canneries in Oregon in 1872. As late as 1888, they were 86% of the cannery workers in California. In San Francisco cigar factories in 1877, the Chinese were 5,500 workers out of a total workforce of 6,500, and half the cigar factories were Chinese-owned. In 1873, half the shoes and boots manufactured in San Francisco were made by Chinese workers, and many of the factories were also Chinese-owned. However, the Chinese were not found in large, unionized industries. The American Federation of Labor would not admit them as members, and AFL President Samuel Gompers was an active supporter of anti-Chinese legislation. The Chinese were forced into economic retreat along a broad front. Eventually, they were backed into two principal occupations: workers in laundries and restaurants. Together, these two occupations accounted for more than half of all Chinese employed in 1920. The small Chinese hand laundry, usually operated by one man, became an American institution across the country. So too was the Chinese restaurant, often operated in a Chinatown section of town. What these occupations had in common was that they were not in direct competition with whites. Similarly, the Chinese set up many small retail stores in rural black communities across the South, operating again without being in direct competition with whites. As in other parts of the world, the Chinese in the United States responded to repressive laws with a variety of schemes to circumvent them. In one decade, more than 7,000 Chinese were smuggled into the United States, at a conservative estimate. These included women who had chosen, or been tricked or forced into, prostitution. White prostitutes also operated in Chinatowns. Drugs and gambling were other common features of Chinatowns, along with violent clashes among various Tongs who controlled vice. The Chinatowns of this era had a wholly unsavory reputation in the surrounding society. Because the Chinese were excluded by federal law from becoming naturalized citizens of the United States, California and other states were able to circumvent the 14th Amendment's barriers against racial discrimination by passing laws against all persons ineligible for citizenship instead of against the Chinese as such. These laws worked for many years, depriving the Chinese of many opportunities and basic rights, but they could not work indefinitely. Chinese children born in the United States, unlike those born in Southeast Asia, automatically became citizens, and these anti-Chinese laws did not apply to them. These American-born Chinese were a small group, but a growing one. Most Chinese females in the United States were American-born at least as early as 1910, but it was 1940 before this would be true of the Chinese population as a whole. The geographical dispersion of the Chinese population over the years also made them less noticeable. The development of family life was decisive for the future of Chinatowns and of the Chinese American population. The physically and socially sordid Chinatowns of the era of lonely men were no longer acceptable to Chinese families and to leaders of the Chinese community. Tongs went into legitimate businesses as Chinatown residents began cooperating with police to stamp out crime and violence, and Chinese businessmen began refusing to continue to pay extortion. Community organizations behind these actions also began to upgrade the physical appearance of Chinatowns, making them more attractive to visitors from the surrounding society. Chinatowns now began to become known as places with far lower crime rates than American cities as a whole. Other factors also worked to improve the situation of Chinese Americans. Their withdrawal from direct competition with whites made it impossible for the anti-Chinese animosity of earlier years to be maintained at the same emotional pitch. Moreover, as Chinatowns changed from being crime-ridden, drug-ridden places and became quiet and colorful tourist attractions, the image as well as the incomes of the Chinese benefited. Finally, the well-behaved and academically conscientious Chinese children were welcomed by public school teachers. Americans in general also became more sympathetic to China after Japan invaded it in the 1930s, and especially after the United States and China became allies during the Second World War. All this set the stage for repeal of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 in 1943. When immigration from China resumed, most of the new immigrants were female, including thousands of wives of Chinese men in the United States. Many couples were reunited after decades apart. Meanwhile, housing barriers and other barriers were coming down. By the middle of the 20th century, most Chinese Americans no longer lived in Chinatowns, but were moving out into white, middle-class neighborhoods. A new generation of American-born Chinese began to go to college and enter professions. Their higher education tended to focus on fields that led to well-paying jobs in the sciences, accounting, or engineering. By 1959, the family income of the Chinese was virtually the same as the U.S. national average, and a decade later, exceeded it. By 1990, the median family income of native-born Chinese Americans was 60% higher than the median family income of native-born non-Asian Americans. Along with the general prosperity, Chinese Americans had some outstanding achievements. In 1957, two Chinese Americans won Nobel Prizes in physics, as did another in 1976. I.M. Pei became an internationally renowned architect. While most Chinese-owned businesses remained modest in size, there was a Chinese-owned chain of stores in California as early as 1939, and in the post-war era, a Chinese-owned Wall Street firm, one of the world's largest individual ship owners, and a multinational computer company owned by Chinese-American Han Wang. The post-war era also brought a new wave of immigrants and refugees from China, often through Hong Kong, to the United States. Many of them began at the bottom, in low-wage jobs in Chinatown restaurants and garment factories, working long hours to eke out a living and repay debts incurred in getting to the United States. Their lack of knowledge of English or of American society tied them to Chinatowns and limited their economic options. Crime rates again soared in Chinatowns as the offspring of these post-war immigrants grew up, often unsupervised by parents working long hours at low pay. Some post-war Chinese youth gangs organized criminal activities with branches in several cities. The post-war influx of Chinese immigrants has been large enough to swamp the American-born Chinese population. By the late 20th century, just over half the Chinese in Los Angeles and San Francisco were foreign-born, as well as two-thirds of those in New York. Moreover, the new immigrants did not have the same regional and cultural origins as the existing Chinese-American community, and so could not socially integrate readily with them. The 1990 median family income of Chinese immigrants who had arrived during the previous decade was below that of non-Asian Americans and only about half the median family income of native-born Chinese Americans. However, the new immigrants also included some well-educated, prosperous, and sometimes wealthy individuals. Even those in the lower economic levels seemed unlikely to remain there indefinitely, if the history of the overseas Chinese is any guide. Even in the poverty-stricken Chinatown on New York's Lower East Side, Chinese banks have the longest hours of any banks in the city. Implications. The highly disparate societies in which the overseas Chinese have risen from poverty to prosperity make it difficult to attribute their success to peculiarities of particular places and times. The almost universal hostility and resentment they have encountered around the world make it insupportable to claim that Eurocentric stereotypes about the yellow peril are at the heart of this phenomenon, when Asians have reacted in very similar ways, and often more violently. Many of the charges made against the overseas Chinese likewise show little correlation with the actual patterns of hostility. For example, the claim was often made that remittances back to China were draining the wealth of the host country, and that the Chinese were only sojourners who did not put down local roots. Over the years, however, both the remittances and repatriation of the overseas Chinese declined and then fell drastically following the Communist Revolution in China, but hostility to the overseas Chinese was not reduced. Similarly, despite bitter complaints that the Chinese do not assimilate, hostility toward them has been no less in Indonesia, where they are perhaps most assimilated and most subjected to mob violence during the post-war era. Resentments against the overseas Chinese have been quite real, however little relationship these resentments have had with the reasons given for it. Nor is simple envy a sufficient explanation. Other groups, both domestic and foreign, have often been much more prosperous than the Chinese without arousing nearly as much hostility. What distinguished the Chinese were, 1. The low economic level at which they began their careers overseas, and 2. The path they took upward. Not only did the overseas Chinese usually begin destitute in a foreign country at a given historical period, new destitute Chinese continued arriving over the years, even after the original immigrants and their descendants had achieved prosperity. Thus, the indigenous populations had continuously before their eyes the spectacle of foreigners arriving poorer than they were and yet rising to surpass them. Inspirational as such stories may be to some, they have proved galling to many others in countries around the world, whether these rises from poverty to affluence were achieved by Igbos in Nigeria, Indians in Fiji, Lebanese in West Africa, Jews in Eastern Europe, or Chinese in Southeast Asia. The prosperity of people born prosperous may evoke envy, but they are no such blow to the ego as the achievements of upstarts. The paths taken by the Chinese during their economic rise compounded the resentments. The activities of middleman minorities, whether a racially distinct group or not, have long been condemned as exploitative by people who do not understand economics, which include many otherwise educated people. Selling the physically identical product to the consumers at a higher price than that paid to the manufacturer or supplier has long been regarded as cheating in some way, even when what has added value to the product has not been a physical change in itself, but a change in its location and availability, which may entail not only transportation costs and inventory risks, but also enormously long hours of work in a store to accommodate customers' convenience. Similarly misunderstood has been another middleman function, the extension of credit, whether through money lending or by making sales on the installment plan. Being forced to pay back more than was lent has long been condemned by many as usury, often forbidden by law, especially in past centuries. Just as in the retailing of products, the crucial fallacy is the assumption that the same thing is being given two different values. The very fact that people voluntarily borrow means that money now and money later are not the same thing. Otherwise, they could wait and accumulate the money that they use for repayments, saving themselves the interest. Some critics of middlemen have conceded that they in fact perform an economic function of value to others, otherwise they would have no customers, but claim that they charge too much for this function. This same nebulous charge could, of course, be made against anyone in any walk of life, from taxi drivers to school teachers to people who sell newspapers. In the case of the overseas Chinese, they often achieved their prominence in particular industries by charging lower prices than their competitors and became prominent as creditors by charging lower interest rates or requiring less collateral. Accusations of engaging in ruinous or cutthroat competition have been made against Chinese middlemen as often as they have been accused of charging excessive prices, and sometimes both accusations have been made by the same individual, though these accusations contradict each other. None of this means that the overseas Chinese have always been blameless or exemplary. In societies where haggling and sharp practices have been the norm, with buyers and sellers both seeking to outdo each other, the Chinese have played such games skillfully. However, their faithful fulfillment of contracts and even verbal agreements among themselves have been crucial to maintaining their own access to credit, without which most small businesses could not survive. Indeed, access to more credit on better terms has been one of the keys to the ability of the overseas Chinese to undersell their competition. That is often called an advantage, but the word loses its essential meaning if it confounds a differential benefit among identical performers and an earned recognition of different performance. Banks have tended to extend more credit to Chinese businessmen because they proved to be better credit risks. The ability of the Chinese themselves to extend credit to others on better terms than their competitors has often been due to a greater investment of time in getting to know individuals, so as to be able to assess their repayment prospects in societies where neither formal records nor legal collection processes can be relied upon. The personal behavior of the overseas Chinese has often been objected to on many grounds. Easygoing and polite people, like the Malays, tend to regard the Chinese as brusque or even rude. In many countries, especially in past eras, complaints have been made that the Chinese lived in unhygienic or unaesthetic conditions and had disgusting personal habits. Such charges cannot be dismissed arbitrarily as prejudice, especially in light of the fact that early Chinese immigrants were illiterate and destitute people, preoccupied with a struggle for survival and desperate to save money to get ahead. The Chinese in the Philippines are an illustration. In the past, Chinese store owners and their Chinese shop helpers, both young and old, worked 16 to 18 hours daily, including Sundays. During the lulls, these tired men, especially the old ones, dozed off to relieve their fatigue. As they slept, their mouths would open, letting the saliva out. To many Filipinos, Inchikpeho, old pig, was an accurate description of the Chinese. The stereotype Inchik Baboy, meaning Chinaman pig, referred to the early Chinese lack of attention to personal cleanliness and environmental hygiene. The poor Chinese coolie or peddler, in his ambition to save a few more centavos, lived an austere, Spartan, unpretentious life. His indifference to a healthy sanitary environment was not helped by his habit of spitting anywhere after clearing his throat. Again, however, history showed no correlation between the complaints and the level of hostility. It was precisely in the post-World War II era, after growing proportions of overseas Chinese had become educated, professional, and had higher behavioral standards, that discrimination and mob violence against them became more pronounced. Throughout the history of the Chinese in Southeast Asia, the criminal activities and violence of the secret societies, or tongs, and the corruption of public officials by the Chinese have complicated their lives and those of the societies around them. The history of the secret societies went back many centuries, and during the period of Manchu rule, tongs enjoyed wide popular support as resistance movements against foreign overlords. Like the Sicilian mafia, however, the secret societies evolved from this role into the role of extortionists and specialists in other criminal activities and violence. Their influence seems to have been greater in the earlier years of Chinese mass immigration. Bribery and corruption, however, seem to have varied with the severity of government regulation in general and racially discriminatory policies in particular. Thus, corruption of public officials by the Chinese was greater during Spanish rule in the Philippines than under the more laissez-faire rule of the Americans. In other countries as well, corruption of officials varied with the economic or other powers wielded by those officials. As the newly independent nations of Southeast Asia generally increased the role of government in their economies and escalated their anti-Chinese policies in particular, the Chinese responded with both ad hoc bribery and more enduring economic connections with government officials. Aside from such pragmatic relationships with officials, the overseas Chinese have usually had little or no interest in political activity in the various countries in which they settled. Preoccupied with economic achievement rather than politics, the Chinese began in the 20th century to take an interest in the politics of China. The idealistic nationalism of Sun Yat-sen struck a responsive chord among overseas Chinese, and the 1911 revolution that ended Manchu and dynastic rule in China aroused patriotic feelings among Chinese abroad as well as at home. These feelings took the very tangible form of substantial financial contributions to Sun Yat-sen's nationalist movement and then to the new Republic of China. This new government's currency was in fact printed by overseas Chinese in San Francisco. The Japanese invasion of China in the 1930s heightened the patriotic feelings of the overseas Chinese, who organized anti-Japanese boycotts in addition to raising money to help China defend itself. These activities brought brutal retaliation later when Japan invaded and occupied many parts of Southeast Asia. China has usually been able to do very little to help the overseas Chinese, and in some ways its influence has been negative in its effects on them. China's announcement early in the 20th century that it considered the overseas Chinese to be citizens of China created political backlashes and legal complications that lasted for decades in Southeast Asia. A surge of Chinese nationalism among the overseas Chinese at about the same time added to the perception that they were aliens and provoked counter-nationalism in the majority populations of Southeast Asian nations. Both the Kuomintang government and later the Communist government of China were active politically and culturally in overseas Chinese communities, promoting political loyalty to China among people who were citizens of another country and infiltrating Chinese schools and other cultural organizations to propagandize and manipulate. Such activities achieved little beyond a heightened hostility to the overseas Chinese among the indigenous populations around them. For much of its modern history during the era of mass emigration, China was too weak to offer much protection to the overseas Chinese. The Americans' abrupt cutoff of Chinese immigration in 1882 was much more complete and unilateral than the gentleman's agreement with Japan that later curtailed Japanese immigration. As a stronger nation, Japan was able to get an important concession for Japanese men living in the United States, that their wives be allowed to join them, and that fiancés from Japan be allowed to enter the U.S. to marry them. Moreover, the bilateral nature of the agreement meant that Japan was not openly insulted, as China was, by a unilateral policy change toward its nationals. With the unification of China under the Communists in 1949, and the subsequent growth of its military power, the effect on Southeast Asian nations was often to make them see China as a threat and their own Chinese populations as potential fifth columnists. China's power was not great enough to prevent mistreatment of the overseas Chinese, but only great enough to provoke such mistreatment. Like some other nations, China used its overseas compatriots politically as pawns in its own maneuvers for national advantage, turning a blind eye to their sufferings in countries with which China had good relations, such as Kampuchea, and ostentatiously coming to their rescue in countries with which China was already at odds, such as Indonesia. All in all, the overseas Chinese have contributed more to China than vice versa, especially during the era that saw creation of the Republic of China by Sun Yat-sen and China's long resistance to Japanese invasions that began in the 1930s. Some observers have lamented the political non-involvement of the overseas Chinese in the countries in which they settled. However, the rise of the Chinese from poverty to prosperity in many countries around the world has generally been more dramatic than that of groups such as the Irish, who were heavily involved in politics and quite successful at it. Moreover, where the Chinese were more politically active, as in Indonesia, there is little evidence that they did better than in countries where they stayed away from politics. Indeed, an argument could be made that they were treated worse in Indonesia than in most other Southeast Asian nations. Chinese political activity in Malaysia, and especially their public gloating at the results of the 1969 election, set off the race riots which led to the new economic policy of widespread official discrimination against the Chinese in education, government, and the economy. However plausible the view that more political activity would have helped the overseas Chinese, the historical record suggests the opposite. As it is, the achievements of the overseas Chinese have been as remarkable as the hostility of others who benefited from Chinese economic endeavors that advanced many nations. Such patterns of response may be a grim reflection on human nature, especially as similar patterns are found in the history of other middleman minorities, whether in Asia, Europe, Africa, or the Western Hemisphere.